Hi, this is Doug Podell. Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. Don't forget, while you're online, to check out the Riff Concert page. It's the Motor City's best for complete rock concert information. For more details, just click on the Riff banner on your Windows Media Player.
Expensive phone bills? Standard phone service can cost a minimum of $30. And for the unlimited packages, it's anywhere from $40 to $70. After adding all the taxes and fees, the question is it really worth it? I'd like to introduce you to Corecom's new product, Voice Over Internet Protocol, or simply VoIP. This innovation allows you to talk to anyone around the world by using your broadband internet connection. With its advanced features, VoIP is revolutionizing telephone service as we know it today. Even more exciting is that this can all be done at a fraction of the price of traditional phone service. Why would you pay more when you can pay less? If you've got high-speed internet access, Corecom can offer you a package for as low as $15.99 per month. When was the last time your phone company offered you any package options that low? As an added bonus, if you call within the next 10 minutes, Corecom will throw in 1 month free. All you have to do is call 1-866-680-CORE. That's 1-866-680-CORE. Call now and mention promotion code WRIF. Or if you register online, type in promotion code WRIF to get your free month. Corecom, revolutionizing phone service one call at a time.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV. Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV. Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
Hi, this is Colleen McDonald, president of Holiday Automotive Group. You know us as Holiday Chevrolet in Farmington Hills, Livonia Chrysler Jeep in Livonia, and Century Dodge in Taylor. We know it's never fun to have to bring your car in for service, and worse yet, if you've been in an accident. But rest assured, our service staff is here and ready to help you. To make an appointment, go online at weloveholiday.com. It's that easy.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV. Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV. Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
We also have special discounts if you need body work on your vehicle and accept all insurance companies. Call us at 866-867-0909 for more information. We're the Holiday Automotive Group. We've got you covered from downriver to Oakland County.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV. Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV. Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Here on the Riff, then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rock rocks.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best Riff Rock.
The way you want it.
Rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Tuesday on 101 WRIF.
Riff Rocks.
much for joining me.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome. Welcome to the broadcast. This is me live. That little blip there was me recorded. You'll hear that at 1 a.m. Eastern Time, one of our terrific interviews that I recorded earlier in the week. Well, I'm just getting overwhelmed with email, and I'm sure you will also overwhelm me with your calls at 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-WRIF. Bush made another speech asserting the U.S. is winning the Iraq War, and we'll talk about that, whether you think it's so or not, whether that's just more of the same, or actually something has opened up. I didn't see it. I started to hear it, and I started to watch it, and I took my own advice not to watch this stuff on television, because we are the object of a carefully crafted speech. I mean, this is true with any politician, but it's even more critical that we have the capacity to think fully and to take time to think about what's being said when this is matters of life and death, when it's matters of the national treasury, what's happening in our own community, all of this. That it's important that we not get sold a bill of goods. And what are politicians known for? Selling us bills of goods, right? It's all throughout history. Nothing's any different. Except this crowd, in my estimation, is worse than we've seen in a very long time. So I said, I'm going to watch this. But the trappings of power, television itself, the official medium, the flag and back, the photographs behind him and all of that, it quiets the critical brain. Also, you have to remember, it's not like Bush is speaking extemporaneously. It's not he's doing this as he goes along. He's thinking how to be honest, how to be sincere, how to really get you and me, the viewer, a full grasp of what's going on. He wants to change our minds, or he wants to reaffirm what he thinks we already believe. So the speech is not even his. He has speechwriters. Every politician, every president has that. Some of them just read them the way Bush does, because he doesn't have the capacity to speak extemporaneously. On the other hand, people like Clinton and some others, they would mark it all up and change it considerably and speak off the cuff, something that every time Bush does, he, of course, gets in trouble. But so it's important to me not to watch speeches like this. I didn't watch Clinton's speeches either, but that was a long time ago now. We are in the Bush era and all that that represents. And so what I did, and 5 minutes after the speech, there it was on the Internet. And you could go through it and think about it and stop and understand that the people that put it together, the speech for Bush to read, don't want us to do that. They want us to be overwhelmed. They want us to be moved. They want to make a particular point. And what they want to do is to get Bush's poll numbers out of the basement and raised considerably. So that's what the speech was all about. Although it is either true or it wasn't. And already one of the emails I got, Matthew listening in Sioux City, Iowa, says, one word, lies. Bush's scripted speech tonight had so many holes in it, he could have driven the space shuttle through it. I never heard so many lies after lies after lies. Iraq is about one thing, and that's oil. Well, I think it primarily was, and to some extent is, about oil. Nothing to do about democracy. I mean, that's where the rubes. I mean, really, if you believe that stuff about there is this altruism. You know, you're doing something for others without any thought of yourself. That's altruism. If you really think that Bush is up to that, Bush Co., Bush Incorporated is up to that, you're really, I mean, I would like to try to sell you something else, to be sure. But now, it's not just about oil. In fact, the idea to go in there, immediately become victorious, have, remember, what was all that hokum that they tried to sell us, that there would be rose petals thrown in the, at the feet of our incoming troops, that the oil would start flowing immediately enough to pay all the costs of the war. So all that turned out to be nonsense. And the idea that this would be a country of U.S. bases, of this huge embassy that would give us a military outpost in that region, that could conceivably go down the drain. I mean, right now, Bush and the Republicans care about one thing, and that's Bush's poll numbers, which are tanking terribly. Although, I suspect this there'll be a real uptick in this. But before I go any further, let me tell you a couple things. Particularly if you're just joining us. This is called The Night Call Show, and I'm Peter Werbe, the host. My last name is spelled W-E-R-B-E.com. You can go to peterwerbe.com to see my website. And our phone number here, 313-298-WRIF. If you'd like to email me, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And this will be the last show till January, because next Sunday is Christmas Day, so no show. If you ever, if you're a regular listener, you know we don't do shows in the holidays. And then the next one is New Year's. So that's it for a couple of weeks. And in terms of greetings, you will not hear Merry Christmas from me, mainly because these right-wingers are trying to make this a big issue. I'm not religious. I don't celebrate any religious Christmas. Christmas to me when I was growing up was a Christmas tree and presents and the family getting together and the relatives coming around and having dinners and stuff like that. But now these right-wing wackos, and they're not even right-wing Christian wackos, a lot of them are just these right-wing wackos that are always looking for these issues to get hysterical about and to separate us and to get put this wedge between us. I mean, they're all worked up that Walmart and Target say, season's greetings or happy holidays. And this, to them, is part of the assault on Christmas, because you know how embattled Christians are in this country. This teeny minority that has to meet in secret, and no one will even admit that they have that religion, right? Well, no, flip that. The opposite is true, isn't it? So this is just another way of trying to divert us from examining the real important issues of our lives and of our communities and our state, our country, and our world. So these people are morons. Well, they're not morons. They are. They're evil morons. They're not even. They're just evil. They're just evil. And remember, evil is a anagram for vile as well. So, I mean, one of the reasons you say happy holidays, right? It doesn't say happy holiday. It says happy holidays. Now, maybe they can figure out that this is a plural. And what does the plural mean? Happy holidays? That doesn't mean Kwanzaa and the pagan solstice and Hanukkah. It means Christmas and New Year's before people even recognize any of these other religions. A lot of this is racist, too. I mean, these guys are worked up about Kwanzaa. They don't like that. They don't like it that, this is a specific black holiday. So they get that's one of the code things behind it. But part of it is they're just goofy. So I used to say, if people would say Merry Christmas to me, I would say Merry Christmas back to them, just sort of out of respect, or it sounded a little weird if they'd say Merry Christmas to me, and I'd say Happy Holidays. But for one thing, they weren't, I mean, it's sort of weird. It's Christ Mass, right? It's a Mass to celebrate the birth of Christ. So happy or Merry Christmas, it's a little weird, isn't it, to be for openers? But what they're talking about and what I'm talking about when I would answer it would be the secular public holiday, the festivities of a Christmas tree and jingle bells and snowmen and Rudolph and all this happy horse manure, right? Or whatever I was going to say. So, but now, since they're trying to force me to do it, you won't get it out of me. If you say Merry Christmas to me, I'm going to say Happy Solstice or Happy Kwanzaa, or do you say Happy, yeah, you do, Happy Hanukkah or Merry Solstice or something. Or, and also Mithra, that which has the identical, I mean, we don't want to say that this was stolen, but, and I can't get this all off the top of my head, but Mithra was an Iranian god who was sent from heaven by his father to redeem the sins of man, and was born on December 25th. I can't remember how Mithra died. Maybe some of you can remember. And then he was resurrected. I mean, story's a little familiar. So I might say Happy Mithra. No, that's just a single person. Anyway, so forget all that. Don't even bother. I don't care what you say to me, to tell you the truth. But anyways, the public festivities are what's important to me. If the religious aspect of it is important to you, then go to church or the pagan. Where do pagans worship? I have no idea. Where do you celebrate Kwanzaa? I don't know. But anyway, Hanukkah, probably homes and synagogues. And Christmas, Christ Mass, you go to churches. So do that. When we say Merry Christmas, mostly it means joyous season. All right? Okay, let's get down to business. I just don't even know what to say. I'm just getting overwhelmed. Some of you who are on my email list, I said, I need your help. 313-298-WRIF. The lies and corruption and destruction of this country's institutions and traditions, as we know, are going so fast and furious. We are in the hands of such corrupt, greedy liars on every aspect of public life that I can't deal with it. It's just overwhelmed me. The ability to get indignant about so many different aspects of the assault on public life by these people that intend to change everything as we know it is more than I can handle. I almost say, not give up and not do the show, or not give up and not be a political activist, nothing like that. But I was thinking, I can't even assemble all this information and all these refutations. You got to remember, Bushco has this full-time staff of hundreds, maybe thousands, preparing these assaults and then lying about them, and these thousands of people that participate in that are paid by us. We work, and then they got speechwriters to construct what he just said at 9 o'clock tonight. None of which is based on anything. I mean, I have the speech in front of me, and I'm going, I could spend the next 6 hours here going line by line. They talk about the election means that America has an ally of growing strength in the fight against terror. How in the world is Iraq involved as an ally in the war against terror? The only reason that there's what he calls terrorists in Iraq, and again, there's no mention of insurgents, of which the Iraqi people met in Cairo and said those Iraqis fighting against occupiers cannot be considered terrorists but must be considered insurgents. All right? Majority of Iraqi people want us out of there after this election, according to the latest polls. But you can just go down this from his cockeyed history of why in the world that we are in there in the first place. A few days ago, Bush said, Bush said Wednesday, the responsibility for invading Iraq based in part on faulty weapons intelligence. What else was it? What's the rest of it? Rested solely with him taking on the issue in its most direct and personal terms in the 1,000-plus days since the war's first shots. He says, it's true that much of the intelligence turned out to be wrong. Much of it, all of it, was all wrong. As president, I'm responsible for the decision to go into Iraq. So we were told that we were in imminent danger, that if we didn't act immediately for this preemptive war, you have to remember that Iraq did absolutely nothing to us. But Bush decided, now, I mean, this is being kind, of course, to say that this was on my part, to say that the intelligence turned out to be wrong. They knew the intelligence was wrong. Anybody with half a brain, okay, that's problematic there, isn't it? They knew there was no weapons of mass destruction. They knew it. And this will come out. Remember, you heard it here. It took too long for Vietnam to turn out that the 1965 incident that precipitated this mass invasion and destruction of Vietnam turned out to be a lie. And we found this out 40 years later. Nothing much we can do about that. Nobody we can bring to task for it. But it's not going to be 40 years this time. We found out almost immediately that this was all wrong. But the president's mea culpa, in other words, I'm guilty, was accompanied by a robust defense of the divisive war. Saddam was a threat, and the American people in the world and the world is better off because he is no longer in power. Well, Saddam was not a threat. He had no way to threaten anybody. He had an army of dust. He had no weapons of mass destruction. And so, you know, people say, well, gee, I mean, we're there, you know, we're close to victory, according to Bush and all that. Yet, remember what was happening? Remember what was happening in February and very early March? The inspectors were in Iraq. Saddam Hussein had no capacity to not allow the inspectors in. And they were beginning to find that there were no weapons at all. That's why Bush attacked, because he knew that they were going to say, hey, this guy doesn't have any. Maybe he's a little weird in not letting us in and all that, but now we're in and we haven't found anything. Well, the regime of Saddam Hussein was beginning to weaken. And if that process would have been carried out, it's very possible that the regime would have collapsed and all of this would have been absolutely unnecessary. I mean, that's hindsight. I don't know that that's true. Talking about Saddam Hussein, he no longer has the power to harm a single man, woman, or child. He's gone forever. The world is better for it. But in the meantime, there's another 30 to 100,000 Iraqis who have been killed, primarily by U.S. forces. This is civilians. This doesn't include the insurgents. So minimum, that's what Bush says, more or less 30,000 were killed. Maybe in as many as 100,000, and you can always triple the number of casualties. So, Saddam is no threat. The intelligence was wrong, but we go in anyways. And who's being fought there? Saddam loyalists and foreign terrorists. That's all. That's what makes up the insurgency, according to Bush in his speech. I don't know. I mean, this could go on forever. We invite terrorism by ignoring them, like he did on September 11th? I guess so. This is what he says. The terrorists do not merely object to American actions in Iraq and elsewhere. They object to our deepest values and our way of life. If we were not fighting them in Iraq and in other places, the terrorists would not be peaceful citizens. They would be on the offense headed our way. Well, the vast majority, in fact, why am I forgetting his name? The guy that leads, Zakawi, that leads the foreign jihadists in Iraq, their numbers are statistically insignificant. There are over 100 insurgent groups that are fighting the U.S. occupiers. Us, right? Let me see. I mean, we could just go on forever. Our forces in Iraq are on the road to victory, and that is the road that will take them home. You could probably go through this sentence by sentence. So Bush says we're winning. Victory is at hand. Well, we should be winning. I don't know that we are, but the war in Iraq is estimated to cost about almost $200 million a day. That's how much we're spending to bring democracy to Iraq. Of course, it's not really bringing democracy. There's these competing groups that are knowing that that the road to power, to the ruling racket in the Iraq that emerges after the U.S. leaves, is through the ballot box. And what you very, this whole thing could split apart. A Shiite state in the south allied to Iran. I mean, most of the Shiites are sponsored by and favorable to Iran. The Kurds could go their merry way. Certainly the Sunnis could link up easily with Syria. But Bush doesn't care about any of this. This is all BS. What they care about is the 2006 elections. So anyways, we're spending $200 million a day of our tax money to bring democracy to Iraq. A total of about $251 billion at the end of October 2005. 1,000 days of the war. This is, by the way, this is from the Brattleboro, Vermont Reformer. That's the daily newspaper out there. Over nearly 2,200 American men and women have died. Nearly 16,000 have been wounded. Estimates of Iraqi civilians range from 30,000 to more than 100,000. One-third of the soldiers deployed in Iraq have been deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan more than once, and on and on and on. And we're doing this, why? Well, we're doing this twofold. One, to bring democracy there. Okay, of course, it's going to be also an Islamic republic, so it's not going to be much of a democracy. And this, most Iraqis disapprove of the presence of U.S. forces in their country, yet they say they're optimistic about Iraq's future. They'd like to get us out of there. So why are we still there? One of the things that would happen if we left, or at least declared no more military exercises, military presence, there would be they wouldn't have anybody to fight. They would stop. That would stop the insurgency. Dick Cheney's there. In the meantime, violence is breaking out once again. And it says the country's sectarian divide, renewed calls for American troops to go home. This is what we're killing and being killed for. All right. Let's see. I guess we can go to some of your... I'm curious to say what you, if you saw it. And like I say, whether it is worth watching... I'd say no. I'd say that it's really difficult to assess a speech like this without reading it. But you tell me. Peter Werbe here with you at 313-298-WRIF. Emails at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Let's take our first call. It's Brady. Brady's calling from Lake Orion. How you doing?
Pretty good, Peter. How are you, man?
Good, good.
First of all, man, I'd like to say you should have a national holiday, man, like Box Day or Post Office Day or like... Christmas or something, you know, like Peter Werbe Day.
Well,
second of all,
wait, as long as we all get the day off, right?
Yeah, that's paid for too. And then first of all, like, I would like your opinion. I seen Bush go on TV today, right?
Uh-huh.
And then as soon as I seen his dumb
face
talking,
yeah.
Right,
yeah,
I thought about last week when right before I started listening to me, it was like the Iraqi elections and all that stuff, and I was thinking, man, I wonder what Peter Werbe was thinking. Like, those people come over here and get citizenship, and they can still vote in their countries. I was thinking to myself, I just had a two-month-old baby. He's going to be 2 months old on 19th tomorrow. That's like saying when he's 21 years old, if someone comes over from, like, Europe, they got the right to vote for their president while they're on vacation over here.
Well, you know, that's actually not too unusual for countries to allow their citizens overseas to vote, or people of even... that extract. I mean, I know there's little countries in Europe, but that's not terribly unusual. Although you wonder, yeah, I mean, why do Iraqis living in Detroit or living in Flint or Indiana, why can they vote in the national elections? I mean, I agree with that. I don't. It's a little weird. But do you remember, it's not an Iraqi election. Essentially, it's a United States election that's setting the terms by which Iraqis can participate. All right, Brady, thank you. And, you know, give a little pat on the head to your baby. All right, let's continue on. Here is Chris. Chris is calling from Toledo. Hi, Chris. Peter Werbe, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing tonight?
Doing good. Thanks for calling.
I just got a quick question for you. Say something terrible happened in the United States, and we had something just totally overturned our country, all right? Saddam Hussein's a horrible person. What would you say is if we had something like this? Wouldn't you want Iraq coming over and helping us out? Just a thought. Just a thought.
Right.
Just a thought.
Okay, I'll keep thinking about it. Thank you. Yeah, all right. How would we feel exactly? That's a good question. How would we feel if suddenly there were Canadian troops or Chinese troops or, I don't know, who else? I mean, people that had traditionally been our enemy, for instance, coming over and, quote, helping us and killing, you know, hundreds of thousands of people if you do the same math. What, we're 10 times bigger than in population than Iraq, so that would be... say like 300,000 to a million Americans killed because another government decided that we needed to be helped, huh? What do you think about that? Here is somebody calling from Lapeer. I don't have your name up here. Hi, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air. Who is this?
Hi, it's Jim.
Hi, Jim. You're on the air. Go ahead.
I just want to say happy solstice to see you too, Peter. I really was tickled by that.
Well, yeah, by the way, I should tell you, Dean wrote into Call Talk Yes at Yahoo.com. He says, pagans celebrate outdoors when they can. I should have known
yes,
that.
Yes, we do. We freeze our asses off.
Let me see, the solstice is coming up when? On the 21st, right?
Yeah, the 21st.
Yeah, now that's an important holiday because that's when the light begins to return. The longest day is over. And, I mean, I like holidays like that.
Yeah, I mean, we just had a wonderful blow-up with my in-laws about Merry Christmas and temporarily got disowned over the entire mess.
What happened? Tell me.
We've gotten a dozen oh-my-God emails about stop taking Christ out of our Christmas. And I'm like, okay, well, stop taking the happy out of my holidays. Was my reply. I said, well, what's so offensive about saying happy holidays? I'm not Christian, as are you, and I want my general appeal to say happy holidays or season's greetings or, you know, instead of going through an entire list of happy Mithra, Saturnalia, Boxing Day, happy Kwanzaa, happy Hanukkah, put on my little red hoodie and start doing Sam, you know, going on a Sam Kinison and such rant and tirade. Then breaking into Happy Gilmore and you name it. And just
yeah, you're right. I mean, because Happy Holidays means this season with so many different holidays.
Yeah. It's a very general, nice, still, you know, saying hey, you know.
I mean, how did people, I mean, it's sort of weird anyways that you, I don't know. I don't get it. I mean, these people are just looking for trouble.
Oh, I fully agree. Yeah. I think it's the silliest argument I've ever heard in my soon-to-be 33 years on the 28th of this month to have heard such an argument with so little basis. We're not taking, you know, Christ out of Christmas. If Christ was born on Christmas, I would say more power to you going to church and having that day.
There you go. Actually, Dean writes in, he says about pagans, they are organizing all over, including in Ferndale. Huh.
Yeah, Southgate has the Federation of Circles and Solitaires, and I have a blossoming group up here to which I'm the sergeant of arms of the Clans of Kindred Spirits.
Wow.
And all we want to do is just sit back, allow everyone to have the fun they want to have, celebrate together, and just remember, the holiday is the holiday.
Well,
whatever day it is, enjoy it, have fun.
Yeah, remember, though, too, it was the Christians who always tried to physically annihilate people from other religions and were particularly repressive of Wicca and pagans, both in Europe and in this country. They're the ones that are so intolerant.
And then, ergo with Sprenger and Kramer with the Malleus Maleficarum. The witch's hammer.
Whatever that
translate.
Yeah, I was going to say whatever that means. All right. Let me say thank you. I appreciate your call. I mean, that must have meant something to somebody, not to me. But let me go. Oh yeah, that's right. I danced with Santa Claus last night. I did. What is it called now? The Ghost Brothers Project. There was a band in Detroit, been together for years, called the Ghost Band. For some reason or other, they called the Ghost Brothers Project. They're playing at the Cass Cafe down by Wayne State University last night, and these Santa Clauses came by the window on their bicycles, no less, three of them, and they kind of had a bodyguard in camo. So they came in and they were drinking beer, and I noticed at least two of them were women. So I asked my wife, I said, can I dance? And the band was playing, people were up dancing and everything like that. So I asked my wife, I said, can I ask Santa Claus to dance? And she said, sure. I don't know if she knew it was a woman. I wonder what she would have said if she would have, she would have said, yeah. So anyways, I went and danced a whole number to the Ghost Brothers Project with Santa Claus. Dean is also saying you never give the World Can't Wait people credit for organizing. Hey, man, you do it like you did. WorldCan'tWait.org. It's on my damn website, WorldCan'tWait.org, and it's not without the apostrophe, okay? All right, let's go back to our phones. Got some open lines for you, by the way, and the number is 313-298-WRIF. It's Maureen in Farmington Hills. Maureen, hi, it's Peter Werby.
Hello, Peter. How are you this evening?
I'm doing great. Thanks for calling.
Well, I have some more comments on Iraq, if you're willing to go that way again.
Sure. Did you see Bush's speech?
I saw the great majority of it, and then I had to take off and go Christmas shopping.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I was wondering why you think that Bush would want to go into Iraq if he didn't truly believe that there was a danger to our country. How would that help his election, or I guess I would say the Republican election in 2006.
Well, it didn't. I mean, it's turned out to be a disaster for him because most of the people that are in his administration are these incompetents, and everything that they've done so far has really failed, beginning with 9/11, the economy, you know, connected up with Ken Lay and Enron and the environment, all of that stuff. So they thought, remember they said this was all going to work just swimmingly. Bush all of a sudden discovered that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, as you may remember. About summer 2002, when when the blush was off the rose of 9-1-1, when his poll ratings were beginning to drop precipitously. The people behind him in this, I'm never always thinking, Project for a New American Century, who had long advocated attacking Iraq and establishing control of oil resources there, the people that were in the government decided now was the time to play the Iraq card. They wanted to invade Iraq. They wanted to create an imperial oil outpost, and they wanted something that would galvanize people behind the Republican Party, which worked just fine in 2002.
You don't think that there was any interest involved whatsoever by Democrats? You think this was a Republican strategy?
I mean, the Republicans or the Democrats have committed their own crimes, but in this, no, it was purely Republicans in this case. I mean, you remember who was the president then?
Oh, absolutely. I just was wondering because I know that Clinton, at the time he was president, thought that there were weapons of mass destruction. Hillary Clinton, as well as Senator Teddy Kennedy, both thought at the time that there was.
Well, Ted at least voted against the war resolution. Hillary Clinton and Kerry and Edwards, they all voted for the war resolution, and they knew there were none. I mean, how did I know that there were none? How did I know that there were none? How did millions of people around the world that had the greatest outpouring of humanity in the history of the planet that demonstrated, for instance, on February 15th, 2003, saying Bush is lying, there are no weapons of mass destruction? How did we know?
So Bush was lying, it wasn't the information. Bush supported that information is what I'm asking. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, I don't know. He doesn't seem like a real bright guy. But the people that were putting it out knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction. Yeah, they're lying. Absolutely lying.
Why didn't the Democrats stand up at that point, do you think?
Because they're a pack of weasels.
Okay.
and losers. And now they're getting a little bit of gumption because it looks like the poll numbers are so much in their favor. But still, and there were a number of Democrats. Our senators both voted against the war resolution. I mean, there were inspectors in Iraq when Bush, finding absolutely nothing, when Bush said they got to leave because we're going to attack.
So you don't think that he did have weapons of mass destruction and got rid of them somehow?
Well, how could he somehow get rid of them? I mean, these are big things. I mean, we had allegedly all these photographs. We had all this inside information that turned out, of course, to have been the ones that, either the people that were totally manipulating or attempting, and maybe to some extent did manipulate the Bush administration. But how come when this Chalabi character that had been convicted in absentia of fraud in Jordan, who hadn't been in Iraq in something like 30 years, when he was the source of this information that was able to get articles in the New York Times, how come it was easy for someone like me to say, this guy, it must be lying on the face of it, and supposedly the smartest and most powerful men in the world believed it hook, line, and sinker? Look, they're either dumb or lying. Which do you choose?
Well, actually, I probably would say that the intelligence failed. I don't know that I would go as far as saying there was a conspiracy behind it, because I think if there were a conspiracy behind it of some sort, that somebody would stand up, some Democrat would stand up and say, because it would in the end be in their best interest. If Hillary all along had said, you know, Bush, I think you're making this up, this didn't really happen, you know darn well she'd be elected the next president, but she didn't. She believed the information as well as everyone else.
Well, it's probably is why I won't vote for it. But, Maureen, I got to go. I feel like I'm way late doing these spots. Thank you for joining us.
Yes.
I appreciate it. We'll be right back to get your calls. Hey, there are some open lines. 313-298-WRIF. We're talking about democracy in Iraq. What about democracy in the United States? What the hell is happening to it here when we learn that our government is spying on us and illegally and unconstitutionally? Right back after these. 313-298-WRIF.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Every successful career has a beginning. Have you started yours yet? Turbocharge your opportunities by calling ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-903-1919. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. If you have an interest in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design, they teach skills that many employers look for. Most programs provide a hands-on education and can help you build your knowledge base and technical skills. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Develop technical skills at an ITT Tech and discover a whole new world of opportunity. Call now for a brochure at 1-800-903-1919. That's ITT Tech, 1-800-903-1919. 1-800-903-1919.
This is WRIF.com.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220. 6 is coming to Detroit, and 101 WRIF and Budweiser have teamed up to hook up your team with two Dell 37-inch LCD HD TVs just in time to catch the big game. Score great Rip prizes, maybe move on to the semifinals. You might get to dust off that Flick football trophy, get involved, have some fun, and win super big. 37 inches big. Just listen to 101 WRIF for details on Budweiser Flick football parties around the Motor City or log on at WRIF.com. So start doing those finger curls and get ready. Bud Bowl 2006 awaits, along with those awesome Dell 37-inch LCD HD TVs just in time to watch the game.
He hooks it perfectly. Has it gone the distance? Yes, it's gone!
The Budweiser Flick Football Tournament. Listen for your chances to win with 101 WRIF.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second segment here. I'd like to hear from you. 313-298-WRIF. Still some open lines for you. Call TalkYes at Yahoo.com. We're talking about the Bush speech, asserting victory is in the, what would you say? It's in the pipeline, and there's either victory or defeat, right? The binary view of the world. And so Bush admits that he got us into this war under false pretenses. He said it was an accident. He just didn't understand the intelligence, or he got bad intelligence or whatever. People like myself, many of you, think he lied purposely and just bit off a lot more than we could chew. And what we've turned out to chew are thousands of deaths of our soldiers and their civilians, and hundreds of billions of dollars of our treasury at a time when we're going deeper and deeper into debt. So we're a debtor nation now, and the younger you are, the more you're going to be paying off this mistake. If this was a parliamentary government, like in Europe or Canada, boom, I mean, he'd be gone. Also talking about these whining, obnoxious right-wing Christians who are got their shorts in an uproar because we're saying season's greetings or happy holidays. Like somehow this is a new assault on Christmas. I mean, this has been around forever. I mean, ever since I was a kid, people said happy holidays, season's greetings, to take in all the public holidays around this time of the year. Not even the religious, other religious holidays, but like New Year's and Christmas, all right? And if you want a religious Christmas, go to church! You don't have to go to Walmart and have it say Merry Christmas. Let's see here. Oh, yeah, and here, this is from Donald. He writes into calltalkyes at yahoo.com. I'm about fed up with everyone wanting me to start believing in their holiday. I'm told to stop ruining Christmas so often. I want to start wearing T-shirts saying openly practicing atheists and stuff like that just to keep the religious wackos away. I don't know. You could probably sell them. All right. Bush says we're establishing democracy in Iraq. I mean, just more of the lying. If anything, it'll wind up to be an Islamic republic. And if only if we're lucky, it'll not turn out to be a country allied with Iran against us, or at least a good section of the population. But also, as we're so-called building democracy in Iraq, we're eroding it here. We've become a torture state. We've become a country that goes to war against all international law, and now we've begun, well, I mean, who didn't suspect this, that we're being surveilled when we oppose the government. In fact, here, let me see. Lawmakers demand domestic spying probe. Democrats and Republicans called separately Sunday for congressional investigation into President Bush's decision after September 11th terrorist attacks to allow domestic eavesdropping without court approval. Russ Feingold, Democrat of Wisconsin, said the president has, I think, made up a law that we never passed. See, this is how Bush is ending democracy. The balance of power is gone. He wants to rule, as he used to joke in the first year after he'd stole the presidency in 2000, saying that his favorite form of government is a dictatorship. And he'd laugh. He said that on four separate occasions. He wasn't kidding. Arlen Specter, Republican chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, says he intends to hold hearings. They talk about constitutional authority, meaning the administration. There are limits as to what the president can do. You know, I think if anyone said, gee, we could torture somebody and stop another September 11th, I don't think there's too many people would say, oh, let's be nice to the guy. I don't think there's anybody that said if we eavesdrop on someone and stopped a terrorist attack, that anybody would oppose that. I don't think if there's anybody that said that by surveilling somebody that we could stop a terrorist attack, anybody would object to that. But ultimately, what happens is that the whole fabric, the whole nature of the kind of country one lives in is altered dramatically. And what I mean by that is, like this, peace groups rage at spying. So here are these Quakers in Florida who are being spied upon by the Defense Department. They're not doing anything. But you got to remember, Bush doesn't allow any dissent at his rallies. There are these Nuremberg rallies where only the party faithful can show up. That people are pushed into what they call free speech zones so they can't get anywhere near an event. Citizens no longer can assemble to redress. What's the language there? In fact, I have it right in front of me. The right of the people peacefully to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. That's gone away, too. The Fourth Amendment, pardon me, about people being held without trial. Search and seizure. So that's what's violated here. The Sixth Amendment. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial. Now we have people tucked away for 3 and 4 years without trial. And you say, well, you know, those are terrorists. I got to tell you, in Nazi Germany, in Stalinist Russia, in any dictatorship you can think of, the vast majority of people were not affected by the oppression and repression of the state apparatus. Most people just went about their daily business of working and raising a family and doing whatever else people do. But the founding fathers knew. That's why they put this all down in writing. That's why they had this checks and balances, because they knew the repressive nature, the inherent repressive nature of government. The history of government is the history of repression. When you start thinking about free governments, you're talking, someone ought to do some statistics on it, 1%. I mean, government arose as a repressive racket to protect the property and privilege and wealth of an elite that had arose. That's why the state arose. That's the only, there was no need for it. There wasn't anything to administer that wasn't being administered communally and collectively before that. The state always was a racket for the rich and powerful. Along, you know, then thousands of years later, some people got the idea, well, maybe, you know, the people that are ruled ought to have a little something to say here instead of just the rulers ruling by fiat, by command, by saying that they're ordained by some god or other and can do anything they want to people, spy on them, torture them. They make the laws. What did one of the King Louis say or something? I am the state or I am the law or something like that. So the founding fathers said that we've had enough of this, and it is so bad that we have to put very distinctly in writing to protect ourselves against this apparatus that we're setting up. Bush is throwing that in the toilet. All right, let's continue on. Here's Nicole in Lake Orion. Nicole, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Peter Werby. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing excellent. Thank you.
That's good. Actually, I just wanted to say that I agree with you about the whole Christmas thing, and I wanted to say happy holidays.
Uh-huh. Can you turn your radio completely off, because we can all hear that in the back?
Yep, hold on 1 second.
Okay. Yeah, you get to hear this twice. All right. All right, you back with us? Nicole from Lake Orion?
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, quick.
Actually, I also wanted to say, I was watching the Bush Co. thing on TV today.
Uh-huh.
And he was saying that all this stuff is to help out the Iraqis. Well, what's helping out the Americans?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, to me, all he's doing is pretty much killing everybody.
Well, think about this.
I mean, everybody's over there fighting, and all we're doing is dying. That's all we keep doing is dying.
Well, you know, Nicole, a lot of people don't care too much about that, as long as it's not them. But think about this. There's like 45 million people in this country without health insurance. And the $250 billion that we've already spent, and actually I think if you did the math a little differently, it'd be a lot higher than that, that's where that money's gone. That's where all the money that we collectively have contributed to the government has gone, either to Iraqis, a massive, vast majority of though, of course, is instead of going back to us, has gone to Bush's favorite and Cheney's favorite corporations. First to prepare for war and destroy Iraq, and then for his other favorite companies to rebuild it. And we're nowhere near the end of this. So as long as we keep swallowing the goo that he's putting out, we're just going to keep losing more lives. The Iraqis are going to lose more lives, and we are going to keep on being looted. All right, Nicole, thank you very much. Thank you for joining us. Let's see. We got to do this one kind of quick. Here is James in Kenosha, Wisconsin. James, I got to do it in about 2 minutes. How are you? Welcome.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Doing great. Thanks for calling.
First of all, I would tell everybody listening that they should at all turns reject the notion of the war on terror. Because as soon as you talk in terms of war, that unleashes all sorts of powers that would never even be remotely accepted, such as spying on U.S. citizens, illegal wiretaps, and the like. And the war on terror is a construct, a rubric of the Bush administration.
Yeah, there's no war. In fact, if you think about it, in terms of our enemies, I mean, we were at one time preparing for this enormous war machine similar to ours that the Soviet Union had and its allies. And we could be talking now about hundreds of men, not thousands, certainly not hundreds of thousands or millions. Now, as we see, that a few people willing to strap explosives on us or grab an airplane can do incredible damage. But this is police work. This is what the police of the United States and the world ought to be doing what they can to track people down on a basis that does not interfere with the rest of ours right to protest and dissent from the government. You know, I have to go to my commercials. My apologies to you. I know you have a lot. Well, what, you want to stay with me, or are you done? Are you with me? Yep, he's gone. All right, we'll be right back.
This is WRIF.com.
The lowdown on the hottest concerts in town are only a click away with a singular wireless concert connection. Log on to the concerts page right now at WRIF.com to find out where your favorite bands are appearing live in concert across the Motor City. Keep it right here on the Riff for your chance to text in to win tickets, backstage passes, autographed rock merchandise, and more exclusively on your singular wireless phone. The singular wireless concert connection from Singular Wireless, raising the bar at 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix, the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
with the heavy hitters, that I'm important. The contacts and exposure Backyard Putting Greens has received has been overwhelming. Yes, the money spent at Riff has been money well spent.
Hi, I'm Steven Rubenstein from Riff Sales. Riff doesn't just rock. Riff works for your business. Call me at 248-591-6833.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
Well, I guess we got the wrong one in there, huh? I'm right back right now. Thanks for joining me in our second hour of WRIF's Night Call. We're broadcasting from Detroit, Michigan. And, of course, we're streaming on the Internet at WRIF.com and also radiopower.org. And we go a long way away, I'll tell you. Our friend Jacob in Oulu, Finland, is listening. Hello, Jacob. Let's see. Dave writes, I love how Bush thinks that the war is a, quote, noble and necessary cause. I mean, he says these things, and it has this ring to it that really brings the rubes in. But if you're reading it, like I did, I just went and got it off the Internet when he was done, you start thinking, noble and necessary cause. What makes it a noble and necessary cause? Well, I mean, maybe to some extent he explained it, but I don't think it washes. He said, I found that I couldn't understand anything the man was saying, so I found the transcript for the speech at CNN.com and followed along with that. Ben says, I do love listening to your show. However, happy solstice, holiday tree, Christmas really was a celebration of Mithra, etc. seems suicidal from removing the right-wing crowd. You cannot win an election if you offend the majority. Anyway, why not turn the issue around by saying Walmart is removing Christ from Christmas because Christ would never pay the low wages and give such poor health benefits that Walmart gives? Well, Ben, I'm not a politician. I'm not going to run for anything, and I just speak my mind. And I think I'm probably more I don't say this like I'm bragging or anything, but I think my views are much more radical than the average person in this country, and so be it. There's always been people that are farther to the left or farther to the right or more in the center, so I'm farther to the left. So what? Yeah, no one's going to elect me. I'm not running around saying vote for the Democrats because they want to take Christ out of Christmas. I'm saying I'm not going to be jacked around by these right-wing Christian fanatics that are trying to split our country on the basis of religion by demanding that I greet them in a particular way, which I will never utter those words again. I mean, I actually did say it here, didn't I? But people would say Merry Christmas to me. I'd say Merry Christmas back. I'm not saying it anymore. I mean, that's where they've gotten with me. How about this, a quote? The national government will maintain, this is Bush's speech, by the way, the national government will maintain and defend the foundations on which the power and life of our nation rest. It will offer strong protection to Christianity as the very basis of our collective morality. Today, Christians stand at the head of our country. We want to fill our culture again with the Christian spirit. We want to burn out all the recent immoral developments in literature, in the theater, and in the press. Who said this? No, it was Hitler. No, sorry. Wow. This is somebody doesn't sign their name. Peter, this is from Andy in Windsor, writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Have you heard the theory that Bushco invaded Iraq not to steal the oil, but rather to impede their oil production? They say Saddam pumped too much oil for Bushco's liking, which competed with Saudi oil. I don't know. I don't like the... I don't think that makes sense. But along those lines, Robert, who's listening, an ex-Detroiter who's listening in Vancouver, British Columbia, says, I can't wait to hear about your trip to Caracas, Venezuela, where I'm going at the end of January. I want to. He says, I want to expatriate there, a real democracy, but after President Hillary assassinates Chavez, I'm not certain any place will be safe to be an American. Well, I don't know. You know, by the way, this Evo Morales, I guess, has won the election in Bolivia, and who admires Chavez and Castro. So another domino has fallen to the left in South America. He's a cocalero, a cocaine farmer. He'll be the first indigenous, I think Bolivia is about 80% Indian, and this will be the first person of an Indian background to become the president. And he's going to, I guess, repeal all this coca leaf growing. God. All right, so I went to Cuba in February, last February. I'm going to Venezuela, so hey, Where am I going next? You got it. Bolivia. I got to learn Spanish. I mean, I used to know Spanish. I was looking at my old like college textbook. In fact, there was even something I took when I was out of college with a friend of mine who's a Spanish teacher. And I have all these lessons written in my hand in Spanish. I can't understand a word of it. I can't understand what I wrote. Let's see here. Okay. All right. Just I a lot of calls waiting, but I did want to get to this. This is just a summary of an article that was in where? Zmag.org. Zmag.org. I got a lot of worthwhile articles at that site. Five lessons Bush learned from Argentina's dirty war and five lessons for the rest of us. Well, here's what Renata, I guess it's probably a woman, what she says. Lessons for Bush. Wage a vast war against an undefined enemy. Number one. Two, create a culture of fear. Three, suppress dissent. Four, consolidate power. Once a national security state has created a culture of fear and suppressed dissent, it may safely consolidate power with minimal questioning by the media or challenge from dissident voices. And five, mobilize, and here's what it's all about, folks. Five, mobilize economic resources to benefit the elite. Besides maintaining power, one of the consequences of developing a culture of fear and consolidating state power is to make economic changes that benefit the elite at the expense of the poor. And in this case, the middle class and the working class. One more thing here. Yeah. This is what it's all about. I mean, this spying stuff, which doesn't do anything. I mean, it's not like it catches people. I mean, the Patriot Act, which the Senate rejected with a coalition of Democrats and Republicans who said, listen, you can't turn this into a police state, Mr. Bush. But this is from Tracy, who is in Port Huron. She says, my husband, Robert, is a regular listener to your show. Recently, he learned of George W. Bush's secretly spying on American citizens, this coming on the heels of the Senate's refusal to pass the USA Patriot Act. My husband has lobbied hard to keep the Patriot Act from being passed. Now he's concerned that his anti-Bush activities, visiting anti-Bush sites and listening to your show, is making him a target of Bush's spies and his spying activities. Not that this would stop him. His hatred of Bush and company overrides his fears. I can now see why he hates the government like he does. Ever since Bush stole the 2000 and 2004 elections, he has developed anti-government beliefs. Well, this is, in a nutshell, the news you've heard, this in a nutshell is what that does to popular dissent, to the right to petition the government for redress of grievances, to peacefully assemble in the way that we do, like here. People go, ooh, I don't want to get in trouble. I better not do this. See? This is how these guys act. They believe that dictatorship is their favorite form of government, as Bush said on four separate occasions. All right. Let's go to, if I can make this little machine work. Come on, get going here, baby. All right, there you go. It's just a mouse, but sometimes it doesn't work. All right, let's go to Tim in Detroit. Tim, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Viva Evo. That's good news that I heard tonight.
Yeah, Viva Evo. I like that. That's Evo Morales.
Hopefully he'll stay in. He's got some pretty good reforms, too.
Yeah, he does.
I wanted to mention something about the WMD thing in Iraq. There are so many lies that this administration has come up with WMD, so many liars that have come out, and one of them is a CIA man named Curveball. And he was there before the war in Iraq, and he had claimed that, of course, the Iraqis had, you know, the nerve agents, aluminum tubes, various other things in Iraq. And the thing is that the CIA itself had put out several documents that Curveball had been a pathological liar, both regarding the WMDs in Iraq and also in terms of the Cold War. He had made up similar statements in terms of, you know, weapons in other countries.
Tim, let me just clarify for people. Curveball was an Iraqi who gave the CIA this information. So all of what's occurred, in part at least, is based on the testimony of somebody they called Curveball that the United States was warned repeatedly by other intelligence services was unreliable. And the deal was, Tim, that they just wanted somebody to say it. They wanted to be able to attribute these reports of weapons of mass destruction to someone. So all this mountain of corpses and this expenditure of tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars comes because George W. Bush, Bushco, believed Curveball. And people say, well, how did you know there were no weapons of mass destruction? I don't listen to curveball. I listen to people that know what the hell they're talking about, like the man who was the last weapons inspector in Iraq that left in 1998. Sorry, Tim, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, you were talking about Scott Ritter, actually.
Scott Ritter, right, thank you.
Yeah, he actually was a lifelong Republican, too. So
and a Marine.
And a U.S. Marine. So a lot of this stuff, I mean, it was known pretty much before the war and also subsequent to the war that Iraq had no WMDs. And the Democrats knew it as well. It wasn't just a Republican conspiracy. It was a political conspiracy. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't, you know, faulty information. The information was actually disinformation.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, it's amazing that you almost have to go back to the Goebbels line that if you repeat a lie repeatedly, as it were, you know, some measure of the population is going to believe it.
Well, you know, I think for the number of times you've called, you're probably at least a somewhat regular listener. My Lincoln dictum about you can fool all the people some of the time. Well, when we've had a catastrophic attack that Bushko's inattentiveness allowed, and there's thousands of our citizens dead, and then rather than trying to authentically get to the bottom of the intelligence failure that allowed September 11th to occur, that Bush and his gang simply ramp up the fear to take advantage of our anger and our legitimate fears to make political points. All right. Thank you, Tim. Thanks for joining us. Here's Dave in Dearborn. Dave, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for joining us here on the air.
Hey, Peter. It's Dave from Dearborn. I know you just said that. I want to talk about two things. First is the hydrogen vehicles. The government and everyone else says that, you know, they can't afford it. The technology's not there. I've got an issue of Popular Science from this month, page 22. Has an article about this, and I'll just paraphrase it. The company in Canada is coming up with a device. It's, they're going to market it next year. And it says it's about the size of a cable box for your TV. You mount it in your vehicle. It says here, the device creates hydrogen through electrolysis by running a current from the car's battery through a small reservoir of potassium hydroxide solution. The resulting hydrogen is pumped into the engine's intake manifold.
Yeah.
And it's mainly for larger vehicles and SUVs right now, and it's going to cost $1,000.
Oh, so, well, let's put it this way. If we hadn't blown $250 billion on this illegal, unnecessary, ignoble invasion and occupation of Iraq, we could do anything.
Exactly.
We wouldn't be a debtor nation. Well, I mean, maybe we should have, and if we hadn't given all this tax break to the ultra wealthy, if we would have kept the surplus, if we would have, I mean, think about the tens of billions of dollars that how we could fix this country. Think about how many things are wrong with this country, the lack of health insurance, of decent wages, of the whole city infrastructure, of states going in debt, of the city cities like the city of Detroit going in debt. None of that had to happen. But what had to happen, given the world view of these elites that gravitate around Bushko, we have to give the money away to his dad's company, Carlyle Group, so we can arm everybody and with these exotic weapons and destroy Iraq. Then so Cheney can continue to take money from Halliburton, give them all these no-bid contracts. And they're still talking about more money. Where's this all going to come from? All right, thank you. Appreciate your call. Let me see if I can real quickly, where the hell did I do that? Somewhere or other, here. Pentagon rolls out stealth public relations. This is from USA Today. A $300 million Pentagon psychological warfare operation includes plans for placing pro-American messages in foreign media outlets without disclosing the U.S. government as the source, one of the military officials in charge of the program says. $300 million. This is what's happening. This is how our money is being spent. $300 million to put propaganda articles in the foreign press. So someone will read them and think, oh, the United States is so nice. I mean, Bush just said these people that hate us are implacable in their hatred of us. So we're going to spend $300 million. I mean, this is what these people think. How about this? Bush pledged Thursday to rebuild New Orleans' shattered levee system, taller and stronger than before Hurricane Katrina struck, requesting an additional $1.5 billion to buttress the system that failed and left the city flooded. Where's all the... They're just going to borrow it. You go to these Chinese banks and say, hey, can we have another billion and a half? Sure. You want another billion and a half? We'll put it on your tab. Man, we've got to do something and do something quick. If these people remain in power till January 20th, 2009, it's possible. Write this down. You can say, see, you said we won't recognize America. That's what I was going to say. You can say, well, it was bad, but it wasn't that bad. I mean, it'll be anywhere from not good to catastrophically bad. And why should we have it not good? Why should a country as wealthy as ours in a world that has a capacity for, or that does have the wealth, and then hence the capacity for tremendous good, why are we only involved in wars? Why aren't we paying attention to worldwide epidemics? Why are there slums? Why is there a planet of slums and on and on and on? It doesn't have to be like this. A new world is possible. But as long, there was a slogan from the 1960s, as long as the hog is sitting in the stream, you can't drink clean, clear water. Right, let's go to Joe in Lincoln Park. Joe, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hello, Pete. How's it going?
Going great. Thanks for calling.
Hey, got two things, really. It's Christmas time. People are going to be out buying stuff, and I'd like to see them try and look at the label and try and find out if it's made in America before they buy it. I know they still got board games still made here.
Well, I was going to say, good luck.
Pizza's still made in China, but there are board games still made here.
Yeah.
So people got to look at the labels.
Well, Joe, actually, I don't know if I said this once before. It's okay. There was a friend of mine's father who was a union president, and when you'd walk in his house, he'd grab your shirt and twist your collar around to see whether you were wearing a shirt that was made in the United States. And so whenever we went over there, we'd say, let me see, let me look through this stuff. Now, you can't find a piece of clothing. I mean, there's some, but it's hard to find them.
Oh, you got to look at the Salvation Army. That's the only place you can get them.
Okay. All right. What else? What was your second
now
pick?
Now on to our George World Criminal Bush character, and he is a world criminal. I think that's what the W stands for. His parents just didn't realize it to start off with.
What a brood Barbara produced, man. Go ahead.
Well, you take two bad genetic strains and you put them together, and this is what you get.
There
but
you
he has violated not only our law, but foreign law. He has invaded a country under false pretenses. He lied to Congress. He condones torture and basically orchestrates it. And he is spying upon U.S. citizens contrary to our law, which I haven't looked up the actual codes, but it is unconstitutional. And the beauty of this thing is...
No, it's you can't have illegal search and seizure. I mean, every one of these, the reason that all those are in there is that they were specifically aimed at the abuses of the society of which they had come from, the English society, which we had a parliament. You know, they had the Magna Carta. They had a political revolution in 1688 that gave parliament predominance, but still the king had the right to do all these things unchallenged. And so that's why it's very specific about you can't do search and seizure, which includes in the modern world wiretaps, without supervision. And by the way, I mean, he said that doing these wiretaps has made the country safer. That's just a lot of hooey. For one thing, there is a court, a special secret court, so that intelligence does not have to be exhibited publicly, that rules on that. You can get these orders to wiretap in an hour. So it's no impediment. It's no impediment to go before this court that would allow it. Bush is trying to establish a precedent of unbridled, unchecked executive power. This is exactly why the Bill of Rights was written, to stop what George Bush is doing.
Must be stopped. And the beauty of the situation is we can get rid of them. There's something called impeachment and removal.
Yeah.
And the Republicans control both the House and the Senate. So they can get rid of George Bush and Cheney, because killing cancer and replacing it with a bullet wound to the head is not going to help us.
Right.
We can get rid of both of them, and the Republicans can still keep their own people in power, and they can still remain in all three branches. So if they don't do that, they're obviously with the Bush conspiracy.
Well, they're sure not going to take that on, and we'll see what happens in 2006. And I mean, you see the Republicans, the kind of viciousness they exhibited towards Clinton over something pretty inconsequential, stupid on his part and inexcusable, but nothing that should have brought the country to this constitutional crisis. On the other hand, this is something of incredible magnitude. This what Bush has done in Iraq is high crimes and misdemeanors and punishable by impeachment at a minimum. All right, thank you very much. Here's Ty and Troy. Ty, hi, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Long time, first time.
Thank you.
Hey, I got a little bit of history for you. Socrates and the ancient Greeks. Greeks had a theory of a perfect democracy.
Uh-huh.
And was to hold elections by lottery.
what do you mean? How do they do that? I don't remember
well,
that.
Well, basically, all right, you have all your bills and everything that the public votes on. Now you have documentation of all these people that have voted on, say, whatever bill that goes through their community. Say, you set an established amount of time that these people are consistent voters, say 2 years.
Okay.
Then they get put into the lottery to be elected to public office.
Uh-huh.
And basically what that does is that keeps all corruption out of politics. You don't have career politicians anymore, which to me, it doesn't sound like a half-bad idea.
Well, it does sound extraordinarily interesting, Ty. The other thing is, and sometimes I crank out these stories about the level of corruption of these Republicans now, and all the things that Tennessee Senator Frist is involved in, and Tom DeLay of Texas, and all tied up with this lobbyist, and you can't even follow it. Sometimes I try to read this stuff about the exposure of the CIA agent's name, and my head begins to swim. I mean, that the these people, you're right. They're like a evil subculture, and you know people understood that, and for a while we're trying to deal with it by term limits. But I don't think that ever. Obviously, hasn't solved the problem either. All right, thank you, sir. Appreciate you joining us. Here is Gregory from Canton. Hey, Gregory, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, Peter. It's the legendary Mr. Positive. Hey.
You're a legend in your own mind.
No. It's a sad point. Don't worry about that. Question. It just bothers me that you seem to be a fountain of misinformation, number one. I don't want to put you down, and
sorry,
I'm not going to. I don't need to. One, you talk about, it seems to me, you say that Bush is the wherewithal, the beginning, the omega, whatever, the omega, the beginning and the end of the this thing with Iraq. I've read many periodicals from your position that it started long before that, number one. Number two, what about the idea that so many people thought that Iraq had the weapons of mass destruction. Three, if you take a lot of, now this is a philosophical question that will render hopefully an answer that I'm looking for, but if you have a lot of choices, does it make the ultimate choice more difficult or easier? I've read a plethora of books.
Well, let me tell you, when I was a kid and I used to sell shoes, they used to tell us, never bring out more than two pair at one time or you'll really confuse the potential buyer. So you always, and you have to say, do you want the brown pair or the black pair? But, you know, when we start using a sales mentality in politics is what goes on, it doesn't exactly foster a democratic process, does it? Well, you ponder that, and we'll go on to our next caller. Here is Stephen in Atlanta, Georgia. Stephen, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Wow, I held for about 5 seconds. That's some great preferential treatment. Thanks, Peter. I want to talk to you about, everybody wants to call in and talk about impeachment and everything, which is, of course, in order But the first step is making sure your congressman is in line with your view of impeachment of this president, to make sure that your own representative in your state's U.S. congressional district is in favor of impeachment. Everyone needs to find out. I really doubt that.
Well, wait a minute. If you're talking about Democrats, you'll be lucky to find five. You're down there like near Cynthia McKinney and all that. She might be for it, and a few others. But most of these Democrats are such weasels. They're never going to do anything that dramatic.
And that's why this is actually every listener that's on here. And actually, you know, I ought to start making these calls and every week, because really we're running out of time. Most of the deadlines happen in July for people who are going to contest the current. I listened to Randy Rose one day, and she said what it comes down to is impeachment starts in the House of Reps, and you need to draw up the articles of impeachment there, and everyone needs to concentrate on their own congressman. Everyone has a congressman, a House of representative in the House.
Mm-hmm.
And like you say, there's just a bare bones, just barely any people that are willing to vote for an article of impeachment at this juncture. Unbelievably, I can't believe it. But
well, one of the things that's happening, there are starting to be some coherent effort towards electing representatives that would entertain a bill for impeachment of Bush and over the Iraq. And the one of them that's just been in touch with me is Democrats.com. In fact, they've asked me to endorse their efforts. I don't know if I think it would be tough for me to do as my position as public affairs director for WRIF. So I might not be able to do that, but they're already endorsing, like, Tony Trupiano, who was a Detroit area talk show host for many years, and he's running for congressional district. Oh, I can't remember either the man, the Republican that he's running against, I think that who beat Lynn Rivers in the last one. I don't know. I mean, I don't put much stock in its possibility, but it's what should occur given the crimes that have been committed by Bushko. So I'm all for the effort. And one thing about giving you preferential treatment, Stephen, I hit the wrong button. All right, thanks for joining us from so far away, home of my friend Mike Malloy. Talk to you some other time. All right, let me go to actually the one that I intended, which was Tom in, is it Conference?
Temperance.
Conference, is that the town you're in?
Temperance.
Oh, Temperance.
Yep.
Yeah, I've heard of Temperance. This is Conference, but whatever.
That's all good. My comment was, if everybody is against whatever happened to a government controlled by the population, by the people,
oh.
You know, whatever happened to that?
Do
you think the people that made the, you know, the form this government would be happy with this government the way it is today?
I don't even think a lot of the politicians that were on the scene like 120 years ago. You know, it used to be illegal for anyone to attempt to influence legislation by, you know, in the way that lobbyists do. That was a strict no-no until a Supreme Court decision, which actually my friend talk show host Tom Hartman says was a mistaken reading of it, but still, all that we see, the buying and selling of votes, I mean, I don't know why that is not, you know, this enormous scandal. The biggest scandal about it is that there is no scandal.
Yeah.
People accept it.
Mm-hmm. It's all accepted.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's hard to accept, though, for seems to be a lot of people I talk to. So,
well, I think here's what I think is happening, Tom, is that most of us have to approach the political and economic world as individuals, and very, very far from where power is actually exercised. So we feel hopeless and powerless and unable to affect events. And actually, that's true. As long as we are these isolated, fragmented individuals, atomized, there's no way that we can ever take on concentrated power, because they control things. They control the economy. They control the political state. They control the police. So what can poor old us do? Well, at this juncture, we're not very well prepared to take on the struggle. But we see all throughout American history, all throughout the world, things change. And they're way overplaying their hand. They could just be, you know, kind of rich and control things kind of subtly, and probably most of us would just go about their business. But they are so greedy, and they are so mean-spirited, and they are so intolerant, and plus they're incompetent. All you got to do is look at September 11th or Katrina and know these people couldn't pour poop out of a shoe if the instructions were written on the heel. So these people got to go. There's enough of us now that realize that we're through being fooled and we're through being tools. And now what we got to figure out, how do we coalesce? How do we stop being atomized? What form do we come together under? The Democratic Party? Well, maybe as a defense. I mean, I voted for Kerry, who I didn't think much of, simply as defensive move. But at some point, we have to begin reasserting ourselves and the kind of values that we want to make this a decent country and a fair country and a peaceful country. All right, with that little lecture, I am going to move on to the next person. Thank you, and I'm going to take this call because it's from out of state. Here is Jim in Cleveland, the home of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. How you doing, Jim? Thanks for joining us.
How you doing, Peter? It's a pleasure talking to you. Thanks. I have a question. Are you aware of the fact that they've already implemented a police state in Cock County, Tennessee?
No, what's happening down there?
My nephew took somebody down that moved back down there from Ohio. And when he got down there, he told me that there were no police around. All that was around were black FBI vehicles. And he said that, I asked him why, he said that all the locals said that they came after the county administration, the people in, you know, in control, because of drugs. They said it was drugs at first, and then they said it was embezzlement. And I was just curious, could this be a way to establish a baseline for future reference in the event that they do wish to impose a police state on us all?
Well, I'll tell you, I have not even heard anything about it, and hopefully there's some people listening in Tennessee that can give us a ring and tell us a little bit more about it. I mean, there may be just some corruption on a local level that necessitated, and federal laws broken that legitimately brought in the feds. But, Jim, I got to go to my, and I don't know the answer, so we'll see if anyone gives us a call. I got to go to my break, so thank you for joining us from Cleveland. We used to call Cleveland Detroit without the glitter. Unfortunately for us, I think the opposite is true right now. 313-298-WRIF. We'll be right back.
WRIF.com. Tired of expensive phone bills? Standard phone service can cost a minimum of $30. And for the unlimited packages, it's anywhere from $40 to $70. After adding all the taxes and fees, the question is it really worth it? I'd like to introduce you to Corecom's new product, Voice over Internet Protocol, or simply VoIP. This innovation allows you to talk to anyone around the world by using your broadband internet connection. With its advanced features, VoIP is revolutionizing telephone service as we know it today. Even more exciting is that this can all be done at a fraction of the price of traditional phone service. Why would you pay more when you can pay less? If you've got high-speed internet access, Corecom can offer you a package for as low as $15.99 per month. When was the last time your phone company offered you any package options that low? As an added bonus, if you call within the next 10 minutes, Corecom will throw in 1 month free. All you have to do is call 1-866-680-CORE. That's 1-866-680-CORE. Call now and mention promotion code WRIF, or if you register online, type in promotion code WRIF to get your free month. Corecom, revolutionizing phone service, one call at a time.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
Hi, this is Colleen McDonald, president of Holiday Automotive Group. You know us as Holiday Chevrolet in Farmington Hills, Livonia Chrysler Jeep in Livonia, and Century Dodge in Taylor. We know it's never fun to have to bring your car in for service, and worse yet, if you've been in an accident. But rest assured, our service staff is here and ready to help you. To make an appointment, go online at weloveholiday.com. It's that easy.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
We also have special discounts if you need body work on your vehicle and accept all insurance companies. Call us at 866-867-0909 for more information. We're the Holiday Automotive Group. We've got you covered from Downriver to Oakland County.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
listening, WRIF.com.
Like what you hear on the Riff? Then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rock. Rocks. Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best Riff Rock.
The way you want it.
Double Rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Two for Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Riff Rock. WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. This is our final segment of Call-In, and then at 1 a.m. Eastern time here in Detroit, in the United States, I say that for people listening all over the country and across the world, we will have a couple of interviews I recorded earlier. One is with Melissa, is it? Melissa Rossi. If I wrote these things down. Yeah, it is. Melissa Rossi. She's wrote, What Every American Should Know About Who Really Rules the World. It actually was pretty scary, and it goes to my last conversation with Tom about the power of these elites and how our power as the people, as the majority of people on the planet, is so scattered. And you know, not bringing it together, well, we this elite can fleece us, and that's what's going on. All right, let's go to Nick in Livonia. Nick, hi, it's Peter Werby, and you're on the air.
Yes, first time caller here, first time listener as well.
Welcome.
Thank you. Well, I've heard some comments. I don't know where to begin. I heard a comment. That's what actually made me call. And then here I'm listening, and there's other things that are being said about impeachment of President Bush and et cetera, et cetera. I'm trying to figure out. What is the topic of everyone's discussion here? There was a comment made that there's electrical fuel cells that we could be using to boost our economy, to make things better in America. But all of the money that we have to bring this into people like us to use is going to Iraq.
Right.
So since we're spending all the money in Iraq, you make the comment, that's why we have no insurance. That's why Detroit's messed up. That's why this or that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you really associate our insurance being bad because we spent all of our money in Iraq? No.
Wait a minute now. When Bush came in, we had this great surplus. Then he gave it away to the rich. Then he started this war. No one's ever had a tax cut. No country's ever given a tax cut to people during a war when you need more money. And we've spent, so far, $250 billion, and it's estimated that we may even wind up to spend $750 billion on this war. So then that limits money for other stuff. And all this money came from you and me, so...
Let me ask you this question.
Go right ahead.
That there can make more sense than anything. I believe the figures. I believe whatever it is. It might have an effect on that. But the truth is there any system or any kind of process in anything, in business, in life, or whatever, that's not going to have any obstacles? If it wasn't for Iraq and having bad insurance, let's say we didn't have a war in Iraq and we had good insurance, there's going to be something else. You can go down the line and blame this is the effect because of that, because the war in Iraq is causing bad insurance. But if that was all peachy, there's going to be something else.
Well, there wasn't, you know, under Clinton, there wasn't, there were still tens of millions of people. I mean, it's the nature of our system where we don't take care of our citizens, where people aren't paid enough, where we work too many hours and get paid too little. I mean, that's what it's all about. I mean, I agree with you that that there's a structural definition to it, but you certainly have the cash available in the wealthiest country in the world to solve all these problems. But what Bush did, everything he did, he chose wrong. I mean, he says here, wait a minute, he says he was wrong about the rationale for going to war in Iraq. He underestimated the dangers. The country has suffered terrible loss, and the bad news isn't over. I mean, I'm reading this from the Associated Press. Well, that's kind of a catastrophic mistake. I mean, a lot of the system rumbles along like it has, never really taking care of everybody that lives within it. But things are getting progressively worse. So the middle class is taking a hit. Wages are stagnated. And the only thing that's going up are the people that have stocks. All right. Okay. Thank you. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Let's go to Wichita, Kansas, and Jacoby. Jacoby, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. I just got to say that this Bush administration, they really don't... everybody talks about their poll numbers being low 40s and that they're on the ropes and everything and that they ain't feeling too good about themselves. I disagree.
What do you think?
They're succeeding exactly. They feel really good about what's going on right now. They said themselves they don't pay attention to polls, and they want to destroy government, and they want to take away anything. There's two different levels to the society that they see. They see an upper tier full of just a couple of, you know, just a handful of people, really. And then a lower tier for everybody else is huge. That lower tier, that's huge.
Right.
And that upper tier is just tiny. It's just a couple people. It's just about maybe like 35 families or maybe, you know, 800 families, something like that, whatever. And then there's those two tiers, and they want to destroy all the programs that help out the unwashed masses, all the poor middle class. They want to destroy the middle class. They want to take away government. They even want to destroy the military. They want to turn that into a privatized situation where they can pay mercenaries to protect them because they need protection, but they don't want all the rules that go along with bureaucracy and government, and they don't want all the details that they can get them caught up in rules and restrict their behavior and their conduct. They want to just do whatever they can and do whatever they do. They want to make United States a rogue nation. They want to intimidate everyone else by way of torture. They want to go out and basically they believe irresponsibly and schizophrenically that they are going to rule for thousands of years to come.
Jacoby, the only thing I don't agree with is that they don't look at the polls. I think they look tremendously at the polls, and I think this is this latest propaganda campaign with all these speeches of Bush and this rosy, even though this AP analysis said there was no more rosy picture. I mean, they said victory is there. I mean, on one hand, they say there's either, you know, retreat and defeat or victory. And on the other hand, everybody's saying, oh, well, we're going to start taking the troops out. They want to take the troops. They want to be able to show what, and I don't know how they're going to pull this off, successes before the elections start, the cycle starts. You know, it's like 6-7 months. I mean, people are already gearing up for it. All right, thanks for calling in from Wichita. Appreciate it. Here is Catherine in Westland. Hi, Catherine. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for calling.
I just wanted to make a comment. I'm coming home from work, and I turned you guys on, and usually I don't listen to the late-night talk shows, but, you know, I love you guys. I love the riff. You know, I'm a big metalhead over here, but I've been in politics my whole life. My father was a politician. I grew up in a political family, and to this day, I work for the city.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I know more about politics than the average bear, you know what I'm saying? And I already knew how this election was going to turn out when the campaign, I mean, the country was torn between two people. One person who says he's going to do all this for the middle class when he's loaded. I mean, what is he going to do for the, and then he scared the crap out of people talking about Korea. And then you got another guy, he's already got a reputation from his father because his father was president, and then you don't know what to expect from this guy, and he was already president, and you already know what he did. So, and this guy was talking about all these choices. Is it easier to make a decision when you have more choices? No, it's not, because you can have a million choices that are John Kerry's and W. Bush's and not one good one in there.
There you
and
go.
You have to make a decision between all of these things that are wrong and you don't know what to do. Bush, somebody had to bring Saddam Hussein out of power, and I know that, but we went about it the wrong way. I think that there's something, I think that they told us that there were weapons of mass destruction to kind of lure us in a different direction. There's some other reason why they're there that they can't tell the public for some reason. Like it would scare us or it's some conspiracy. And I don't want to say conspiracy because it's kind of a hard word.
Well, but Catherine, that's not the way democracies are supposed to work. The people, since we're far away from the sources of information and power and intelligence, we're supposed to get an accurate description of reality so we can make decisions. We got an absolute inaccurate description. And so people said, well, yeah, God, if this guy's making atomic bombs and might attack the United States, we should take him out. Right?
Yep.
Yep. All right, thank you so much. I appreciate your call. Let's see, maybe we get some more information on that county in Tennessee. Jason, hi, you're on the air. Do you know what our other caller was talking about?
Yeah, my father lives down there in a small town not far from there called Philadelphia, Tennessee.
Okay.
And basically what you got going on down there is a bad Dukes of Hazzard episode with the local law enforcement.
Uh-huh.
The feds came to break up, believe this or not, an illegal cockfighting ring. And once they got in there, they found out that the local law enforcement is running drugs, prostitutes, and all kinds of good stuff, and I'm not for big government, but it was really a situation where it needed to be stepped into.
Right. You know what's interesting, Jason? The suspicion that so many people have. I mean, it's easy to poo-poo the caller, I can't remember who it was, from Cleveland, and say, oh, man, was he being silly and exaggerating what it was when it was just some simple local crime. But it shows, I think it's instructive to show the level of suspicion that people have about the way things are going.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not for the big government, but it was really, my dad lives down there, and if you read local newspapers, you wouldn't believe some of the things that go on with the local law enforcement. And it just seems to be that small corner of Tennessee, to tell you the truth. But, it was, I feel it was totally justified, and I just didn't want the wrong idea to get out there.
Well, I appreciate that, Jason. Thanks for calling us.
Yeah, thank you very much, sir.
All right, have a good night. Bye-bye now. Here's Eric in Belleville. Hi, Eric. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Yeah, I guess from your last comment there, I don't understand what's going so wrong.
Going so wrong where?
I mean, just with all that's going on or whatever, we needed to get Saddam out of power.
Why did we need to get Saddam out of power? And B, where does the United States get the right under international law to get anyone out of power? It violates the Charter of the United Nations, which Bush says that he adheres to.
So
we're in violation with the United Nations?
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, Bush committed a crime against peace. He attacked a nation who did nothing to the United States, that in no way threatened the United States. And it was all based on, if you're kind, on misinterpreted information, and if you're unkind, but I think more truthful, on a pack of lies. I mean, why did we have to get Saddam Hussein out of power?
I don't know. Why do we have to support Israel? Why do we give all of our money to all these other nations?
I don't think we should. I don't think we. I think we ought to get out of the Middle East in general. I don't think we ought to give Saudi Arabia any money. I don't think we ought to give. I mean, think about, you know, our tax dollars or your family's tax dollars that are going to Saudi Arabia, Israel, Jordan, tens of billions to Iraq. I mean, think about our problems here. Why isn't this all being spent in our country?
Well, I guess a little bit for world security. It's kind of a little bit always been that way, and that is not to say that that's the way it should be.
Well, I think all it does is make things more insecure. All right, I got to rush through these calls because we're almost at the end. I'm just going to go to Chuck in Waterford. Chuck, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Okay, if I may, I'd like to talk for a moment about history and then make a point about the future. First of all, history, our political history. People say we have two-party system. If you've ever seen a ballot, we have more than two parties.
Right.
Originally, there was only one party. Then it splintered in the early 1800s. The Democrats and the Whigs became the two dominant parties. That lasted until the antebellum era, at which time we went through a great period of turmoil. Both parties splintered apart. The Democrats survived it. The Whigs went to pieces and ceased to exist. Out of the turmoil, the Republicans rose to prominence. And since the Civil War, it's been the Democrats and the Republicans have been the two dominant parties.
Chuck, we got about 2 minutes left for the whole show, so bring us up to the 21st century.
That's history. The future. Neither the Democrats or the Republicans are doing us any good. They're too busy kissing big business butt and not doing anything for the average American. What I'm thinking we need to see is, like, just as the Whigs and the Democrats splintered apart, I'd like to see them both splinter apart and go away. I'm looking for something new. I don't know if it's an existing party or something new over the horizon, but I'm looking for a new political party where somebody's going to stand up and lead us in a new direction, because we are surely going in the wrong direction.
I'm not going to give you a single argument on that one. Thank you, Chuck. Thanks for calling us. We'll see what is ahead. And let's see. Here's Tom from Plymouth. Tom, hi. You're on the air. Tom, are you with me?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Go ahead. Turn your radio off.
It's actually Tom in Pontiac. I just wanted to call on tonight and say that I really enjoyed the show, and I don't really have a lot of time to go over much, so I just really wanted to say, you know, enjoy the show, and I listen every week, and I hope things start straightening out soon.
Well, I appreciate it, and I see that you wanted to talk. We have no time now to talk about the economy. That's what we have to talk about one of these days. Here's Zach in Port Huron. Zach, hi. You got about 60 seconds.
Hey, Pete. I just watched the president's speech tonight on TV. And I couldn't believe how backwards it seemed. It just seemed like what he was saying was the exact opposite of what the truth is out there.
Uh-huh.
And I've been watching a lot and reading a lot on the Internet about the 9/11, what happened. And, I mean, I might be going out on a wing here, but I think all that was a giant conspiracy. And it was just built to build up a lot of publicity, almost like wagging the dog, you know, for President Bush. And I don't know. I think people really need to start investigating on their own into 9/11, because if they looked and knew the amount of information that was out there about that, they'd be very surprised.
All right. Thank you very much, Zach. Yeah, there's a lot out there. In fact, put in 911 conspiracy. Go to my website, peterwerbe.com, PETERWERBE.com, WERBE.com. Go down on the left. There's a 911 link. Hey, happy everything to you. Happy holidays, season's greeting, happy lifetime to you. Happy New Year, because I'm not going to be back until, I can't even do the math first, but like I think it's the 8th of January. So next Christmas is off, and next New Year's Day is off as well. So it'll be a few weeks before we talk. Hook into my website if you want to hear more of my broadcast. You'll find information there. So stay tuned. Got a couple of great interviews for you after these.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Every successful career has a beginning. Have you started yours yet? Turbocharge your opportunities by calling ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-903-1919. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. If you have an interest in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design, they teach skills that many employers look for. Most programs provide a hands-on education and can help you build your knowledge base and technical skills. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Develop technical skills at an ITT Tech and discover a whole new world of opportunity. Call now for a brochure at 1-800-903-1919. That's ITT Tech, 1-800-903-1919. 1-800-903-1919.
This is WRIF.com.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Let me put it another way. We talk so much about democracy, and democracy essentially is the rule of the people. You and me, those of us who make up the vast majority of the population, we're the ones who make the decisions. That's formal democracy. So that's the way it goes? Well, you're dreaming, I guess I have to say it. There are some democratic forms in this country and other places, but Here's a book that's going to set you back on your ear. It's called What Every American Should Know About Who's Really Running the World, The People, Corporations, and Organizations That Control Our Future. My guest is Melissa Rossi. And Melissa Rossi is also the author of What Every American Should Know About the Rest of the World. We interviewed her a while ago. And let's say welcome back to Melissa Rossi. Hi, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Hi there, Peter.
How long ago was it with your other book?
2 years ago.
Okay, good. It seemed like just yesterday, and it was. Now, I should say, reading through this, it's rather frightening. And maybe of all the elements that make up the undemocratic control of our world, the one that surprised me considerably in terms of the wealth they control and the power they have is the mafia. I mean, we'll get to the other little mafias or the bigger mafias in government, but tell us some about the international mafia and the different manifestations of it. Jeez, it is so frightening.
Peter, you're hitting on one of the most interesting elements of the book, I think. We think of the mafia as the Italian mob, and those are the little puppy dogs of the mafia right now. I mean, the Russian mob, the Chinese mob, who are called the triads, the Yakuza out of Japan, they're doing everything from running slaves to introducing new kinds of drugs, little things like tobacco smuggling without paying taxes and things like that. But one of the most important things is at least 1 million, some estimates say 2 million women and children a year are being enslaved by the mafia. And they think they're signing up to be maids or cocktail waitresses or au pairs. And instead, their passports are taken away, and these people literally for decades are slaves. Surprisingly, at least 50,000 of them are in the United States.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and they're coming in, and maybe there was a scandal where there were some that were turned up to be hotel maids in Florida. And so they're very much, it's part of our system, and we don't realize every time that we're buying something, the whole oil industry is hooked in with the Russian mob. So there's a lot of the things that we buy that we're actually contributing to the mafia because whoever supplied it had to pay protection money for it.
Wait, let's go back to the oil industry. I mean, if we're gassing up at like a mobile station, the mob somehow has their finger on this?
Well, actually, the Russian mafia is so much in control of Russia and the mineral resources there that it's believed that about 60% of the banks, at least, are really held by the Russian mob. Okay?
And we do get Russian oil.
Yes.
Yeah,
they're not one of our top suppliers, but we do get Russian oil. They've moved into the East Coast and bought up a lot of stations there. And they have all kinds of little scams where it's heating oil and getting around taxes. But yes, they're very much in the United States. They're very much all over the world. The mafias, and I use that as a plural, are setting up branches all over the world. They know globalization like nobody else.
Well, it's silly old us. We go to work, we get a paycheck, we go to the supermarket, we fill up our gas tank, we watch television, and we go to bed. And there's all these nefarious forces that you chronicle in What Every American Should Know About Who's Really Running the World. You mention in the book the estimated amount of wealth controlled by the different mafias. Could you relate that figure? It's astounding.
About a trillion dollars that they're laundering a year.
Yeah,
is that the figure you're?
That is. I mean, that's not a minor player.
No. That's much larger than most world economies.
Yeah, and
most countries' economies.
And in your section about the mafias, you talk in some cases the toughest gangsters from the Sopranos and the Corleones. They were just the Godfathers. The Russian mafia just walked in and said, "Well, I can only do the Italian gangster. You're out of here." You know, I mean, right? They just
took over their gambling joints, they took over their routes. That's how hardcore the Russian mob is. You know, the Russian mob and it's believed some of the Albanian are also, they believe that they're responsible for some of these computer worms and that they're hacking into a lot of the corporate systems, too. Now, one of the most interesting kinds of actions of the mafia are the Japanese. and they'll become shareholders of a major corporation, and then they go to the corporate meetings, and they'll have some dirt on the CEO, and they tend to also arrange sex vacations, and maybe the CEO took a sex vacation previously, and so they'll go to him first and say, you know, if you don't pay us, you know, this amount of money, we're going to come to your meeting and humiliate you. So it's embarrassment is one of the forms they use in Japan.
Actually, what do you call it? The shame, what is it?
The shame game.
The shame game, right. Yeah. So they, well, I was going to say, you know, there's always been criminal elements, and what usually we're concerned about is if it threatens us physically or if it's going to cost us money. Well, certainly if we're, people are being kidnapped and sold into either wage or sexual slavery. I mean, that's pretty serious. And when they're fooling around with commodities, that's going to wind up costing us more as well.
Oh, they're getting so sophisticated. They're just all over the board. I mean, you know, corporations and banks are having to ultimately deal with the mafia because they're getting into their systems. I mean, they are all over.
Well, let's go to some of the other sectors that rule. I mean, the democratic process is what we tell ourselves and what we argue so much about in this country. Who else are the big players here? I mean, your book, What Every American Should Know About Who's Really Running the World, the assumption is that it's not we the people.
Well, I think we're losing it, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is to keep people up to date, keep people informed, so we can point some fingers and demand accountability. But one of the groups I think that's been very important in shaping our domestic policy is a group called the Council for National Policy.
Mm-hmm.
It was started in the 1980s by Tim LaHaye. Now, does that ring a bell?
Sure, best-selling author that never gets mentioned as a best-selling author, but remind our audience as well.
Well, he sold 63 million books of the Left Behind series, which has to do with the rapture. It's a very, it's a religious, it's or Christian horror story. And essentially the message is, if you're not evangelical Christian, you're going to be left behind, and it's going to be hellish.
We should say, by the way, Jimmy Carter's book that currently is on the best-seller list of the New York Times has sold 150,000 copies, and we're talking about LaHaye's book, 63 million.
Yeah, well, that's a series too.
Yeah.
But I mean, he has made so much money off of this. But what people don't bring up is that he's a political strategist. So he started this Council for National Policy, and some of the people on the board and who have been in the board in the past are actually want to put in, believe it or not, a theocracy, and make the Ten Commandments the rule of the land. These are very powerful people, and they've hooked arms with billionaires, such as the Amway, the head of Amway, a lot of the very wealthy, very ultra-right, and I mean, I'm not just saying right, I'm talking ultra-right, and very ultra-right Christians.
Now, that's that has a Michigan connection, because if I had at least half a brain, I could remember the woman's name who is the wife of the owner, and she's going to be running for governor of Michigan.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, they're moving into, and some of them identify themselves on, and some of them are self-candidates. And so, but what we're seeing is there is a move. And there's nothing, I mean, I'm a Christian. I have no problem with Christians, okay? My problem is when people are not saying what their agenda really is. And I also am very much opposed to this marriage of church and state, which the Bush administration has brought in numerous ways, including with their faith-based initiatives, which are now social, what were previously programs that came out of social agencies, are now being farmed out to religious groups. Now, what people aren't pulling together on this one is, look at Hamas, look at Hezbollah, look at the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, these are, at least the first two, are considered terrorist groups. What they do in the Middle East is they provide social services. What the Bush administration is doing here is setting up so the Christians are providing the social services. It's an incredibly powerful position to be in. To be helping people out and to be instilling your values. And it's worked really well for Hamas and Hezbollah and the Muslim Brotherhood. So, I mean, people aren't making that parallel.
Yeah, but, can we say one nation under God? Iran, there's one, right? I mean, if you think about
it. They were the first. They were the first to kick it all off. You know, there's a whole movement right now. People have probably seen... It's a really interesting issue that I don't think has been very well debated, but the Ten Commandments in federal buildings or in courtrooms, and also what you were just saying, in God we trust. I mean, that's on our money. There's a movement, and it's been in the past couple years, to put that up in federal and other government buildings. Now, what it's believed this is really about is to say the Bible is the foundation of our government. The Bible was really key for our founding fathers, and that really, when we come down to it, the Bible, not the Constitution, is what we should be listening to. Mm-hmm. I find this very
scary. Yeah. Melissa Rossi is my guest. She's the author of What Every American Should Know About Who's Really Running the World. In Michigan with Wealth, it is Betsy DeVos. That's the name I was trying to think of, one of the owners of Amway. Now, talking about some of the corporations, now most of us take it for granted that corporations have a much, much greater impact on politicians and legislation and social policy than do isolated individuals like ourselves. So one of the really powerful ones, and has a direct connection into the White House now, is the Carlyle Group. And you mentioned that in your book. I wonder if you could tell us about it.
Well, they're a private investment firm. So Carlyle takes the money of mega millionaires and billionaires and invests it for them. Now, one of the things that put Carlyle on the map was they brought in Frank Carlucci. Now, Frank Carlucci is this name that everybody should know, and nobody does. He was a former Secretary of Defense. He was number two at the CIA. He was a former NSA. I mean, the man had a lot of power within government. Then when he was pulled in by the Carlyle Group, it was right after the Soviet Union had fallen. So suddenly it looked like all these arms companies and corporations were going to go down the tubes. So he bought them up and invested in them and sort of shaped them up and held them for a while until they became wildly profitable. But he's one of the key players there, but it's also James Baker II. George Bush Sr. was part of it. So when you have these former leaders and former power mongers, you have a couple problems. One is they have often put in policies into effect when they were in office that they can now make use of now that they're on the other side of the fence.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, you have the Carlyle Group, which has a lot of arms holdings, that when there's a war against, say, Iraq, there's an invasion, a lot of this weaponry is used up through the destruction of the physical infrastructure of the country. Now, we're spending billions of dollars to repair what it was done with Carlyle Arms, and who does the rebuilding here?
Yeah, well, and then you have Halliburton.
And Bechtel.
That's Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
Dick Cheney. So where you have Carlyle, so the president or the president's family is actually making money from us going to war. Then you have Halliburton, Dick Cheney's company, former company, who he, until recently, he's still maybe receiving his final paychecks from, and is still, despite his denial, is still seems to be very much involved with. So Halliburton's coming in, and not only cleaning up and getting billions of dollars worth of contracts, they're ripping off the U.S. government to the tune of a quarter of a billion so far that we know of. So it's a very masochistic and strange relationship if you look at the numbers and why the U.S. government keeps on giving Halliburton contracts when I was talking to people who they were the first wave of people that went over to Iraq. Halliburton was supposed to build their barracks for them. These guys had to build their own latrines. Hmm. There was nothing there. There were no showers. Halliburton did not come through. So this is another conflict of interest.
Now, I'm sort of looking at this as a list, and in your book, What Every American Should Know About Who's Really Running the World, we were talking about people controlling an extraordinary amount of wealth, and hence they have great impact, the corporations, the mafias, and some of these people seem, well, I mean, less so. Like, just on the back of the book, you have, like, Pfizer listed and the Reverend Sun Myung Moon. How do they function in a manner that is like detrimental to the democratic process, do you think?
Well, with Pfizer and with some of these corporations, It's that they have so much concentration so that they can control, they can start dictating prices, they can start dictating policies. Pfizer, the whole drug industry has so many lobbyists that this whole Medicare bill that went through that's confusing everybody really benefited the, that was what pharma wanted, that's what pharma gets. And it's the same with credit cards. They have so many lobbyists and they have given so many political contributions that even though Congress every so often makes some lame effort to try and rectify the fact that there's absolutely no control on credit cards right now. Credit card companies still keep on getting policies or laws passed that behoove them. I mean, recently the Bush administration or Bush signed a bill outlawing certain forms of bankruptcy. So it's really hard to declare bankruptcy from your credit cards. Well, if you're late on one payment, you can see your credit card rate suddenly go up to 33% or more.
Mm-hmm. Now, in you have a chapter that's always dear to my heart about media matters, about who's powerful within the media. Do they really, in your estimation, play a role similar, I mean, to many of these other wealth and power brokers, or are they just people that have influence over what we're thinking?
Well, there's a couple issues there. One is, again, concentration. So you see just a handful of corporations, including GE and Disney and Rupert Murdoch's companies, controlling too much. And so you don't get a variety of information. And in the case of Rupert Murdoch, I mean, the man has quite frequently used his media outlets to elect people that he wants to promote his other projects, his movies, his TV shows, whatever. So there's a conflict of interest there. But I think going back to the media, that they have really let us down lately. They have not. Investigative reporting is laughable at this point. They bought line, hook, and sinker the whole spiel about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And people talk about the liberal media. Hello, it was the New York Times that told us that. It was Judith Miller, who I'm so glad finally pushed away from her computer and quit. But we have a media that is not on it, and one of the reasons they're not on it, it is asserted, and I do believe, is because the corporations are controlling them, and it's just getting increasingly hard to tell the truth. There's not budgets for investigative reporting in a time when we really need it.
You have chapter of that I consider to be incredibly important called The Oil Beast and Addiction, and both what we need for to feed the energy that propels this society, and how then also it intersects. I mean, you were saying earlier how Russian oil has the taint of the Russian mafia on it, but then we have like the Saud family as well. Now maybe you could kind of intertwine that oil and the Sauds.
Well, you know, one thing I think that's really interesting about the Sauds is they are the number one as far as proven reserves. They are number one, but we, because of September 11th, have this opinion that they're out of control. Well, not that they're out of control, but we don't. What I'm trying to say here, Peter, is that the Sauds have the same problem with Al Qaeda that we were having. I mean, they're not running. They're not successfully taking down their high rises, but they are doing car bombs all over the place. So you have a royal family who is, on the one hand, just very, very wealthy, while the actual populace of Saudi Arabia is getting, and until recently was getting poorer and poorer, and it really was getting about a third of the income that they had gotten during the 80s. So they were. Not at all happy. They didn't have enough money to get married. And it, so on the one hand, the royal family is really wealthy. On the other hand, they're supposed to, you know, bow down to the religious establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their conflict of interest. Is, you know, they are known for having wild parties. They're known for lavish, foolish expenditures and not helping out the people. So the people in Saudi Arabia are getting, I think, really fed up with the royal family. Although when King Fahd died and former Crown Prince Abdullah became king, I think he has a much better rapport with the people. But the thing is, we don't like the Saud in general, the Saud family. But if they go, we will see some real problems, because it probably will turn into an Al Qaeda or a terrorist or some kind of extremist sort of a situation, not unlike Iraq. And
well, I think many, you know, given the many, many reasons other than what was actually what was said by the Bush administration for the invasion of Iraq, one of them is a concern about what will happen in Saudi Arabia. And I think people keep talking about Bush has no exit plan for Iraq. Initially, I don't think they had any intention to exit and wanted to have a forward base that that could control oil events and military events in that region.
I think you're absolutely right. And the other thing was, finally, we were having to pull out of Saudi Arabia because we had still had thousands of people there from the first Persian Gulf War. And so, but Saudi Arabia, because of the people being really upset, was saying, get out, get out, get out. And they finally just pulled them out. I believe it was spring of this year that the last people were pulled out. But they didn't have a base. They have one in Qatar, but it's nothing like the things they had in Saudi Arabia. And I think that's exactly one of the things that they wanted, the real estate. They wanted the military base that they were losing in Saudi Arabia, and they wanted to establish in Iraq. It doesn't look like that's going to happen.
Melissa Rossi, your book, What Every American Should Know About Who's Really Running the World, The People, Corporations, and Organizations That Control Our Future, is extraordinarily informative, but it's frightening because the whole idea that little old you or little old me can have an impact on a world that is controlled by these wealthy, powerful, and oftentimes physically aggressive elites isn't very heartening. I mean, I don't even know if I want to put you on the spot by asking what the hell we can do. We're always out, to quote one of my favorite books, we're always outnumbered and always outgunned. And I know, you know, we had that thing, you can't fight City Hall. Well, you can fight City Hall, and people have always been able to beat City Hall when it came down to it. But we're talking about something a lot bigger than City Hall.
True. Well, I think in some places, in some of the fingers, places I'm pointing my finger, and where I think the American public should be pointing their finger, are things that can be amended. Some of these problems can very much be changed, but we need to unite and we need to decide that this is a priority. And right now, there's such division in the United States. I find it horrifying. But I think there's things that we can unite on and say, like, we don't want to be lied to anymore by our government. We don't want to be propagandized by our government. If the General Accountability Office is demanding culpability or receipts from Dick Cheney's office, he cannot give them a bag of gibberish and doodles and a pizza receipt. That is not acceptable. You know, so I think things like that, with government, we can make them more accountable. With corporations, we can make them more accountable, whether it's through letter-writing campaigns or not buying their product anymore. So I think there are ways, and even in the course of our life, you know, maybe we can carpool. I mean, I know that's a really old-fashioned idea, but if we can lessen our dependence on the individual use of the car, or Walmart. I mean, Walmart is responsible for what is it? $18 billion worth of goods are from China, right?
Well, they are essentially China's wholesaler in the United States, or retailer in the United States. Yeah.
Right. And so, for every $100, it said that a consumer spends, $9 is spent at Walmart. So I'm not saying boycott Walmart, but maybe we don't want to go there every day.
No. Well, I think too, it's not entirely fair for me even to ask you that, because if someone would have asked an African American in 1954, the thing, how are we going to end segregation? And they would go, oh, gee, I don't know. It's pretty, you know, it's pretty rooted in the American culture and economy. And I don't think too many people said, I got an idea. Let's have a bus boycott. So what happens is that I think that the reason these elites are reigning so high, riding so high, is that they don't have any challenge. The ordinary people were thinking, what the hell can we do? But there is a mysterious way of which suddenly it all, the resistance and a vision of living differently all comes together, and I think that's the optimism I have.
Yes, and I do too. But I think, you know, step one is identify the problem.
Yeah, and you have done it magnificently again, Melissa Rossi, in your book, What Every American Should Know About Who's Really Running the World, The People, Corporations, and Organizations That Control Our Future. It's a Plume book. You can go to penguin.com. Thanks for joining me on The Peter Werbe Show.
My pleasure.
This is
WRIF.com.
The lowdown on the hottest concerts in town are only a click away with a singular wireless concert connection. Log on to the concerts page right now at WRIF.com to find out where your favorite bands are appearing live in concert across the Motor City. Keep it right here on the Riff for your chance to text in to win tickets, backstage passes, autographed rock merchandise, and more exclusively on your singular wireless phone. The singular wireless concert connection from Singular Wireless, raising the bar at 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix, the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. Well, here we are, the holiday season, and I just came back from the ear doctor. I know you don't want to hear about that, so I'm not going to tell you. But I heard people talking about the economy, about their jobs, about what they can afford to spend on Christmas, what they think the future of the economy is. And ultimately, it's all wrapped up in the jobs and the wages we get for those jobs for the vast majority of us. Joining me is Beth Shulman. She's author of The Betrayal of Work, How Low-Wage Jobs Fail 30 Million Americans. It's brand new in paper from the New Press. And she's also co-chair of the Fairness Initiative on Low Wages. Beth Shulman, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, we talk about this being the richest nation in the world, the wealthiest nation in the world, and it is, but still there's an extraordinary number of people who are working, and as the subtitle of your book, The Betrayal of Work, suggests, there's tons of people with jobs that don't work real well for them.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there was a kind of an assumption or a promise in America that if you worked hard, you'd be able to take care of yourself and your family. But for over 30 million Americans, one out of every four workers that promise has been broken. One out of every four workers makes less than $9 an hour. And that's just the start of it. You know, low-wage jobs are the least likely to provide health care coverage. They're the least likely to provide retirement. They're the least likely to provide time off to be with your family, whether it's sick leave or family leave. And these are the most hazardous jobs in our economy and require the most nighttime hours, which makes childcare hard to provide.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say $9 an hour because that's closing in on being twice the minimum wage. Not quite, but it is. And I was thinking, even if you make $10 an hour, that comes out to what, about $20,000 a year?
That's right. And we know, you know, throughout the country there's been really reports on basically how much it really takes to provide for just your basic needs. And that's almost double, you know, what we talk about as the poverty level. And so, you know, it usually takes at least around $36,000 in most communities and far more in many to just, you know, meet your basic needs. So $9 an hour isn't even approaching that.
Mm-hmm. Now, the title of your book, The Betrayal of Work, essentially that's what you were saying, is that people work hard, they provide needed services to the economy and to our communities, yet they really don't have the wherewithal to provide for themselves or their families. Is that essentially what the betrayal of work means?
It certainly is. And it really is a betrayal because, you know, there was a whole concept around work. We value work as a nation. Yet work is not providing the kinds of rewards that we all assumed it was. And again, it's not just that the wages are poor. That's bad enough. But, you know, workers aren't getting health care coverage. They're seeing their retirement benefits being cut back or eliminated. Time off is scarce. And, you know, low-wage jobs are hazardous. You know, people are standing on their feet. They're getting back problems. You know, poultry processing plants are having to cut every moment. So, I mean, it's a really hard life. And again, it's just not, these jobs are not providing what we assume they would.
Well, Beth Shulman, there's got to be at least one listener out there that's thinking, oh, you bleeding heart liberals, without even making an assumption about your politics, that's what the market provides for these people. If their labor was worth more, they would receive more. And if they were more aggressive and showed more initiative, then they could move upward and onward, as so many other Americans have.
Well, first of all, you know, I wrote this book because it was in the middle of the welfare debate, and I was seeing people who were doing exactly what America asked of them. They got up every morning, they put in a good full day's work, and couldn't make it for themselves and their family. So these are people who are doing everything America has asked of them. And again, what we've done is stacked the deck against them. We've kept the minimum wage at $5.15 an hour. It's been there since 1997. It's $2 less in value than it was in 1968. So what we've done is we've let the floor keep falling so that people aren't able to make a decent living. We've also made it very, very difficult to organize unions. You know, workers get fired. They're intimidated. They're harassed by their employers if they try to organize. So a lot of the ways that we would ensure that people have a basic, you know, living wage has really been cut out from underneath these workers. And there's nothing to say. It makes no sense whatsoever that whether or not people have health insurance should be based on whether your employer decides to give it to you. Health insurance is not just a kind of a privilege for the few. It's a basic right that every American should have.
Well, I kind of presented the argument in the crudest way. Let me say it in the manner that it often is heard from people that think if you interfere too much with the processes of the market, that it'll have a detrimental effect on the economy. So that, again, I'll just repeat the last part of what I said, is that the market is determining the value of the labor purchased by people that you were talking about, the you know, in your subtitle of your book, the low wage jobs that fail 30 million Americans. They don't have big hearts, and they would say that's the way the cookie crumbles.
Well, it's a real myth. I mean, one of the things I talk about in my book are the myths around, you know, the economy, and one of the greatest myths is that the economy is somehow some force of nature. that, it, again, it just kind of works by itself. But we make decisions every day about how our economy works. We make decisions about how much or how little we allow other goods to come into this country, whether we subsidize corporations, which we do every day, whether we give tax cuts to corporations, whether we give corporate welfare. We do that every day. So, you know, the notion that there's somehow this, quote, free economy is just a myth. And so what we need to ensure is that we make decisions which ensure a basic quality of life for all Americans who are out there working hard, doing everything we've asked.
Now, I often, to be provocative, but in good part serious, I say since this country prides itself on being number one, and unfortunately in social indices of well-being we're usually not anywhere even near the top, that at least we ought to have the top minimum wage in the world, at least among the Western countries that legislate it. And I'm just pulling this right out of my memory, and you may know the figure better than I do. I think in Germany it's like $11.50 or $12 an hour. And I say, well, in order to be number one, we ought to make the minimum wage $13 an hour. And then we can chant number one, when anyone mentions minimum wage. Of course, the horror, the reaction, is that this would cause, you know, incredible inflation. It would, people would have to be laid off. I mean, it would, in other words, it's sort of the blackmail argument that if we raise people's wages to a decent level, it's going to, you know, everything's going to get worse rather than better.
Well, I mean, that's so fallacious. First of all, we don't hear any of the arguments when CEOs make millions upon millions of dollars. No one gets out and argues that it's bad for our economy that they're making so much. First of all, when people get paid well, they actually invest in our economy. We create healthy communities. The services, government services, are less needed if people actually, you know, can have basic, you know, livable wage and basic benefits to take care of themselves. So that notion that somehow it's bad for our economy is a crazy statement. I mean, after World War II, we made sure we invested in workers through the GI Bill, through investment in infrastructure, to build a middle class in the United States. And that created prosperity across the board. And that's the kind of prosperity we want to have in America.
Well, why is it that, for instance, I mean, I'm sure there's small business owners listening that probably just choked on whatever they're eating at the particular time of the day they're listening to this, thinking, what? You know, $13 an hour, I would go out of business. And that could be possible for a number of very, very small concerns. But how do they do it in Germany? How do they do it in other European countries that have an aggregate wealth that's so much less than ours? That's what the mystery is. Or is it a mystery?
I think it is about how we distribute our wealth in the United States. You know, I don't think anyone's saying that we should have a minimum wage of $13 an hour.
Except me.
But ours is at $5.15 an hour. So, I mean, even if we, you know, raised it to at least $8, $9 an hour, I mean, you know, we're still so below anything that would even come close to something reasonable. So, I mean, one of the differences, certainly, in Europe is you see that, you know, it comes through the government. Government essentially provides, you know, basic health insurance, you know, so that it's a very different way of viewing a society. We are far less concerned about whether everyone in our society has the basics of a decent life. We're so skewed the other way. We have the greatest inequality of any industrialized country. Our low-wage workers are the worst off of any industrialized country. What I'm saying is that if people work hard, they should at least be able to have the basics of a decent life.
My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Beth Shulman. She's the author of Betrayal of Work, How Low-Wage Jobs Failed 30 Million Americans. It's new in paper from the New Press. We don't like to talk about, I do, but I'm the guy that wants to have $13 an hour minimum wage. We don't like to talk about class. I mean, that seems so European and it doesn't fit into the American myth of class mobility. But many people think that it was Katrina that really brought to public consciousness the idea of class again. Do you think that's so? Did Katrina suddenly bring this all out pretty starkly?
Well, I think it was so in our faces to watch watch people who lack the means of escaping a hurricane. You know, I mean, you know, so that that basically what you were seeing is just in graphic detail, you know, Americans left behind. And what we've done is very much that. I mean, when we look at the issue of class, one of the real concerns with the great inequality that we have is that we're going to start to see generation after generation essentially stay in the same class. And one of the problems is that the very means of mobility is being denied to those with the least amount of income. One of the most compelling things in going around the country for my book, The Betrayal of Work, was seeing the impact of low wages on workers' children, because their children were the least likely to get any kind of quality child care or pre-K. They went to worse schools that lacked the resources that many, certainly higher-income schools do. And even if their kids could qualify for college, they didn't have the means to send them. So their children were at a tremendous disadvantage compared to other children in the United States.
When you say you traveled around the United States, so this isn't all statistical? You were actually looking and meeting people that qualify as poor?
Oh, absolutely.
Tell us a little.
Well, I went everywhere from, you know, California to the northern part of Georgia, interviewing people in poultry processing plants and trailer parks. So, I mean, I really saw very vividly what it really means to not make enough from your job and not have the basic benefits. You know, one woman in New Jersey said to me that, you know, she doesn't allow her children to go outside in the wintertime. And I said, why not? You know, and she said, well, if they get sick, I don't have health insurance.
Oh,
so
boy.
If I take my child to a doctor, they always require you to pay up front, and I can't afford the $50 that they're charging. You know, you don't even think about that. Most Americans don't think about making a choice as to whether your child goes outside or not based on whether or not you're going to be able to afford what it's going to cost at the doctor.
Mm-hmm. When I was saying earlier about European version, or no, what would you say, perception of class being determinative, is that at all true in the United States? In other words, that in Europe, throughout the 19th century and into the 20th century, there were such huge struggles based around class that's pretty much part of the European mythos or their sense of their societies. That's not really as, although there are certainly incredible strikes and unionization and all that here, that seems to be lost. Do poor people, and I mean that's a big generalization, of course, do they take this on as individual failure, or do they understand it as being structural?
I think most Americans see their problems as individual. And that's part of the reason I wrote the book. You know, this is structural. It's not individual when 30 million Americans can't make enough to support their families. It's not individual when 44 million Americans don't have health care coverage. This isn't the fault of an individual. This is the fault of the system. And there's things we can do. For instance, in Michigan right now, there's a state minimum wage ordinance that's going to be on the ballot. I mean, that's the kind of thing we need to be doing to ensure we start to raise minimum wages around the country. We need to start pushing for bills that say to corporations, either you've got to provide health insurance or pay into some fund. We need to get, you know, we need to level the playing field for those employers who are trying to do the right thing but can't compete against those who aren't. We shouldn't allow the Walmarts of the world to determine basically the standards in our economy and our lives.
Ms. Shulman, let's talk a little about who the poor are. There's a lot, I think, stereotypes about that as well, particularly in low-wage jobs. I've heard people say, well, most of those are teenagers anyways. Who occupies the low-wage jobs?
As I said, there's a lot of myths about the jobs and the workers in these jobs. First of all, the workers in low-wage jobs are adults like the rest of us. Less than 60% are teenagers. So these are adults with family responsibilities. There's also a myth about what these jobs are. There's a tendency to think of low-wage jobs as kind of fast food jobs or something that's somewhat peripheral to our economy. And the reality is these are nursing home workers and child care workers. They're janitors. They're security guards. They're home health care workers. They're educational assistants. They're hotel workers. They're the jobs all around us that are in the very mainstream of our economy. And the myth that you talked about, Peter, that I think is the most important is people think of these jobs as merely stepping stones to better jobs. But basically half of workers never get beyond kind of the lowest income group in America. And that's an amazing statement. I mean, the fact that we think of ourselves as an amazingly mobile economy, and yet low-wage jobs end up being low-wage careers for too many Americans.
Yeah, and if it's structural, there's always has to be someone occupying those positions. So if someone gets a job with middle-class income, someone else is going to fill that. I know people often say, well, these people have to get education. And sure, it's great for all of us to have as much education as possible, but I've made the remark that if everyone in this country had PhDs or equivalent postgraduate degrees, that you would have people in McDonald's with PhDs in French Renaissance history working for $7-$8 an hour.
You're absolutely right. I mean, training and education is absolutely essential for individual mobility. But, and this is the great important thing, is that, in fact, low-wage jobs are some of the fastest-growing jobs in our economy. So if we're going to ensure that people have the basics of a decent life, we need to do something about the rewards of these jobs.
Well, and when we talk about a class system, which we're not supposed to really, it's even worse if you identify it essentially as a caste system, that there, in fact, is fairly small mobility between classes. Mostly people that are wealthy remain in that class. Most people that are middle class. I mean, we know people, I'm sure each one of us know people that someone was born poor and now they're a millionaire, or some millionaire that's now living on Skid Row. But statistically, as far as I've seen, and you can tell me whether this meets the statistics you see, that there's not a great amount of class mobility.
There isn't, and that's the thing. You know, if you have great inequality but enormous mobility, you can argue, well, look, you know, people move in and out of where they're, you know, where they are, and so it really doesn't matter as long as you're mobile or have really the ability to move up. But, you know, it is. It's the rare exception that really moves up, you know, to, you know, out of kind of a low-wage income family into kind of a high income. We love to tell those stories. You know, they are the classic Horatio Alger stories, or the stories on Oprah, you know, of the person who made it in spite of everything. There are those stories, but we've made it so difficult for people to succeed and move up. We need to eliminate those barriers so people actually do have the kind of mobility we've talked about in our society.
Beth Shulman, we just have a little bit of time left, but let's talk a little more about the stereotypes very frequently, and hopefully this doesn't mean much to too many people, but the stereotype is that also low-wage workers are predominantly people of color.
The reality is the about two-thirds are white, majority are female. Disproportionately, you do have, you know, minorities in low-wage jobs. But this is a mainstream problem in America. This isn't any one group who really has the problem. This is an American problem, and we're going to have to address this in the 21st century.
And how about men? So we're, you know, white men. You know, it's supposed to be our deal. How are we faring?
You know, you're faring a little better than women, but again, you know, everyone is, you know, there's over 30 million Americans making less than $9 an hour, and, you know, about 55% of those are women, so 45% are men. So, you know, it's a problem both for men and women, both for black, white, brown, and yellow. This is a problem that's an American problem, and again, has to be addressed. If in fact, we're going to live up to our values about how we reward work and how we live up to our promise that if you work hard, you can take care of yourself and your family.
Now, this all sounds so reasonable and fair and decent and human, yet this is nowhere near on the political agenda, or is it? I mean, we have living wage ordinances and what have you, but in the main, the huge structural problems of wealth inequality, it's only people like yourself and some of our friends like at United for a Fair Economy and others that are addressing this.
I really think there's a disconnect between what's going on at the local level, where you do see a lot of energy around really trying to address these issues, and the national dialogue. As I said, in Michigan, you've got, you know, going to have an election to see whether or not next year to raise the state minimum wage. That's been a revolution across the states. You have living wage ordinances, which say that if you're going to get taxpayer dollars, you have to provide quality jobs, which is only fair. It's our tax-paying dollars. Why should it go to companies that are providing poverty wages and no benefits to their workers? You're seeing ordinances that say to the kind of Walmarts of the world, either you provide health insurance to your workers or you've got to pay into a plan, because right now taxpayers are subsidizing hugely profitable corporations who are refusing to provide benefits to their workers. Those are happening at the local levels, and you're seeing coalitions coming together to really make that happen. So I'm optimistic that that kind of energy and focus is going to at some point translate into the national debate.
You know, if I had, of the 100 reasons I love this job, one of them is that I love to hear people that are optimistic, because very frequently I'm pessimistic about what's going on. But oftentimes social movements, they're just kind of there with the stalwarts sort of enunciating the problem, and then suddenly, poof. But as it stands now, overall, it's that old dictum of increasingly the rich getting richer and the middle class, now the middle class, the working class, and the poor are getting poorer.
That is happening. What we are seeing, again, is I think, you know, the rich can afford all the basics, and the rest of us are struggling, I think, to provide health care for ourselves and our family, to provide a decent retirement, to provide, you know, an ability for our kids to go to college, all those things. So, again, I mean, one of the things I guess that keeps me optimistic is looking at what we have succeeded in America. At a time where we never thought we would ever eliminate segregation, we passed the Civil Rights, you know, Act. At a time where certainly there was vast gender discrimination, you know, we've passed the Civil Rights Act. You know, at a time where there was environmental, you know, people were dumping things into river that were environmentally horrible, we've passed environmental laws. So, and we decided that the elderly shouldn't be impoverished or go without benefits, so we passed Social Security and Medicare. So we have addressed issues as a nation. And it's just that this issue, the issue around income, the issue about whether or not, you know, working people can actually provide for themselves and their family, that's the issue I think that's going to be on the table for the 21st century.
Beth Shulman is the author of The Betrayal of Work, How Low-Wage Jobs Fail 30 Million Americans. It's just out in paper from the New Press. And Beth Shulman is also co-chair of the Fairness Initiative on Low Wages. We just have about 30 seconds left. Is there a website that we can go to see more information or hook up with you in other ways?
There's the Fairness Initiative on Low Wage Work, or if you just do lowwagework.org.
Thank you very much for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
It's my pleasure.
WRIF.com. Tired of expensive phone bills? Standard phone service can cost a minimum of $30. And for the unlimited packages, it's anywhere from $40 to $70. After adding all the taxes and fees, the question is it really worth it? I'd like to introduce you to Qorcom's new product, Voice over Internet Protocol, or simply VoIP. This innovation allows you to talk to anyone around the world by using your broadband internet connection. With its advanced features, VoIP is revolutionizing telephone service as we know it today. Even more exciting is that this can all be done at a fraction of the price of traditional phone service. Why would you pay more when you can pay less? If you've got high-speed internet access, Qorcom can offer you a package for as low as $15.99 per month. When was the last time your phone company offered you any package options that low? As an added bonus, if you call within the next 10 minutes, Qorcom will throw in 1 month free. All you have to do is call 1-866-680-CORE. That's 1-866-680-CORE. Call now and mention promotion code WRIF. Or if you register online, type in promotion code WRIF to get your free month. Qorcom, revolutionizing phone service, one call at a time.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
Hi, this is Colleen McDonald, president of Holiday Automotive.
Automotive Group. You know us as Holiday Chevrolet in Farmington Hills, Livonia Chrysler Jeep in Livonia, and Century Dodge in Taylor. We know it's never fun to have to bring your car in for service, and worse yet, if you've been in an accident. But rest assured, our service staff is here and ready to help you. To make an appointment, go online at weloveholiday.com. It's that easy.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
We also have special discounts if you need body work on your vehicle and accept all insurance companies. Call us at 866-867-0909 for more information. We're the Holiday Automotive Group. We've got you covered from Downriver to Oakland County.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
On the riff, then why not get your riff rock to go?
Download all your favorite riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rock Rocks.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
Double rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF.
Riff Rock.
Oh, no, this is a nightmare.